the Department of Labor and then to the Portfolio Committee on Labor. Now we will be, for the very, very first time, actually start engaging the individual seaters. Up to now, what we've done, we received reports from the department, from the ministry, on the landscape and the reconfiguration, the Director General. We also received reports on the performing seaters and the underperforming seaters and then the non-compliant seaters. We received reports on the National Skills Fund and the universities and how the seaters and all will align itself into the integrated landscape and a seamless landscape, which the minister would refer to as the post-schooling options. So we are now starting to move to the actual seaters because we've received all those briefings. There's a draft out, and that draft, we suggest that all the role players in the public domain have to engage on it so that we can come up with the best possible formation between government and parliament and ensuring that the voices of our people are being heard in that space. Also welcome to the two CEOs and the chairpersons, as well as their representatives, as well as to the Director General and their team, including the Minister's office that's present. This meeting also comes at the back where we've, in fact, have sent out a request just around the strategic plan, the mandates, the budget analysis of the last financial year, a SWOT analysis, and then how does these programs land on the ground for our people? There is a general perception that from the ground that it's really difficult to get to the seaters. We know the seater landscapes in provinces and the coordination of those landscapes, as well as the what we call the skills development forums in the provincial governments. There is different levels of efficiency and different levels of importance attached to those structures. What we do know is that there was a serious underspend of billions of rand in the context of the National Skills Fund over the last couple of years, not hitting home to the ground. We've seen the mandatory allocations and the non-mandatory or the discretionary allocations. And really, literally the question is, how does it impact on our communities? Also, we've circulated at present a question, I think, in the end of February. There was 8 or 9 strategic questions, but it all related to how does all of the money that we've got impact on our society. We are busy analyzing that. So we've got all the information, facts on information. Some seaters have given very much information, a lot of information, and some has done what good bureaucrats will do, is hide all the information, and that's also fine. So we'll be doing a analysis and then actually starting to engage with very specifically the questions which were not responded on. We'll be asking them specifically to report on that. As the members, we've got all of us from our various communities and constituencies, as well as from all political parties and structures in society, that we need to hit the ground, that we need to be able to impact and deliver. Some would argue that in that space there would be meddling. Some would argue there's no meddling. Some would argue, but why is there so much interest in the seaters? Why is there not so much interest? The reality is that there is a view that the majority of what's happening in that landscape has not yet hit home impactly, rapidly on the ground, and therefore words like ratchet up, activist parliament, and all that comes into being. And we will do that unapologetically. We will ensure that we get to some of the bottom issues on those things. So with that, we'll start with health and welfare. And I suspect that you've decided rather to come yourself, though you are on study leave, I think. Also, we want to thank you for that. And let's hear what the Health and Welfare Center is all about and some of the strategic issues. I think we've given 20 minutes or 30 minutes presentation time, and thereafter we'll have interactions. So we'll ask members to, if there's really a need to immediately clarify, then we'll allow that, but generally at the end of the presentation. And we'll have quite an interactive session. And then we'll go to the next one. I think it's the Chewy's holiday today, and therefore I think the services CTCO requested if he could be apologized, and they've written to us asking if their presentation can stand over, and I thought it is a fair request made. I think there was also another CTCO that, the wholesaler, the CEO was overseas, or is overseas, and that's the request. Members, that's really it. So it's essentially we would have tackled four seaters, but the CEO specifically requested to be here, and they were not able to attend, and therefore they've requested, and I've allowed that to take place. For that, the CEO of Health and Welfare, over to you.
Good morning, committee, chairperson and DG and committee members. My name is Corey Smith. I'm the chief executive officer of the Health and Welfare CETA, and I've been in this position for the last two and a half years. Chairman, I followed the guideline that you've given in your letter, so our presentation is basically aligned to what was requested. And if there are any additional questions, of course, we're more than willing to answer that at the end. In your presentation, you asked, or your document, you asked that we start with our mandate.
But do you want to introduce your team?
Oh, my apologies, Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I have with me our CFO, Ms. Elaine Braas, and then our Vice Chairman, Mr. Esam Fingwana. Unfortunately, our chairperson is unavailable due to illness. And our Vice Chairman, who is a Western Cape resident, could you just stand in? And we appreciate that. Thank you very much. So going on then, in terms of your document, you asked that we highlight our mandate to you. And our mandate, in fact, has been captured in our Constitution. And it basically allows us to facilitate and coordinate and monitor the implementation of the National Skills Development Strategy for both the health and social development sectors, to identify the skill shortages in the sector, to support the development of skills of employees in the sector, to improve the quality of life prospect and labor mobility of employees in the sector, to strengthen the institutional capacity of the HWC to improve the productivity and quality of services that we provide to our stakeholders, and to increase the level of investment in skills development and to improve the returns on such investment. It further requires of us to improve performance and productivity in the workplace, to improve the employment prospects of persons previously disadvantaged by unfair discrimination, and to ensure access to additional funding from the National Skills Fund that will benefit our sector. Then, of course, the support is required for the implementation of the revised or the new National Qualifications Framework, and then to support the qualifications SAQUA and its three quality councils, and then to support the introduction of the QCTO. That, in short, gives you an overview of our mandate. And I must say, from previous discussions, people quite often misunderstood what it is that we're supposed to do, and it's always refreshing to start with this so that we have a clear understanding where we're coming from when we speak about the delivery of our projects. In terms of our strategic objectives for 10-11, the strategic objectives have been captured for quite a while now and has been in our CETA for more than 3 years since I've been there. But basically, we focus on to create a focused strategy that will direct the HWC CETA to achieve both its national and sectoral objectives. And, of course, we build on our performance to ensure service delivery standards are acceptable to our stakeholders, the effective utilization of financial resources, and be accountable for the financial health of our CETA. to create a culture that empowers and enables staff to perform and to establish and maintain a management team that adds value to the HWC's deliverables, to develop and implement sustainable internal business processes, and then lastly, to deliver on the objectives in, described in our business plan. We have a saying in the HWC, if it's not in the business plan, it's not happening. Our business plan guides our delivery, and I often say to managers, if you do anything that you cannot directly link to your business plan, you're not working for the HWC, you're working for somebody else. In terms of the budget, I'm going to ask Ms. Brass to just take us through the numbers, and she will explain not just the 9-10, but also the next year's budgets.
Thank you. Good morning to the chairperson, committee members, DG, and other members today. To take you through the budget and actual of 2009-10, so it's just a reflection on the year that has just gone by. Our actual for 9-10 on our levy income has far exceeded the budget for the 9-10 financial year, a surplus of about 13 million. Our investment income has also exceeded our budget income for that period, as well as our government levy contributions. We've had strong contributions by our government departments, and they have supported us in the last financial year. So there again, we've actually collected 4 million above our budgets for that particular year. Our total expenditure again is also under budget, which is what we achieved to do. So for instance, administration expenditure, our actual was 44 million, but our budget was 49 million. So we've actually spent under our budget for the 9-10 financial year. Our mandatory grant expenditure is actually under budget, not a great position to be in, but also to indicate that the participation of employers in WSPs for the 9-10 financial year has increased compared to the prior year. So we've got a 70% participation in the 9-10 year compared to 62% of 2008-2009. So there has been a substantial improvement in participation. Our discretionary grants, we've spent 88 million.
Chairman, may I ask a question? Just a clarification. Investment income, could you just explain what those investments are?
Absolutely. We are conservative in our investments. It is investments in the bank, it's cash in the bank, and it's either on call or on fixed deposits. We don't invest in anything but call or fixed deposits, and we invest in the three major banks. We invest in First National Bank, Nedbank, and Standard Bank.
So that's essentially cash holding.
It's cash holding, and
the use of the term investment is misleading. I wouldn't use
it. Yes, correct. Thank you. It is cash holdings and interest on cash holdings. Thank you. Our discretionary expenditure, we spent 88.5 million rand in the financial year compared to a budget of 60 million. But that indicates that we have now tapped into our reserve. So it's actually a very good position to be in, and we're quite pleased with that. At the end of the financial year, 9-10, we have a surplus of about 24 million rand, which then goes back into discretionary grants. So it allows us to then have further funding for discretionary grants. And we have spent just over 2 million rand on capital expenditure. In the last financial year, our resources were obtained and utilized in accordance with the budget. Tight control over administration expenditure was exercised as described. The budget amounts have not been exceeded, excepting where indicated, but that was a good exceeding of the budget. Discretionary grant expenditure exceeded the budget, which is a good position to be in. And as indicated, our participation of employers in mandatory grants has increased substantially from the prior year. So we've got 70% compared to 62% of 2008-2009. Now, to have a look at the year ahead, our budget, our SDL revenue, we estimate that to be 181 million compared to the last financial year, so roughly about a 7.4% increase that we're expecting. Our government levies, we've budgeted for 30 million. Remember, in the last financial year, we actually collected 34. So that is quite conservative. Our interest is a lot lower because we are expecting to actually pay out substantial monies in terms of discretionary grant funding relating to our commitments. Our mandatory grants, we've estimated at 114 million. There we are actually estimating 100% participation. In reality, that doesn't happen, but for budget purposes, we put it in as 100%. Discretionary grants, now that is just our allocation of our SDL revenue for discretionary funding for that particular financial year. However, there are reserves that we also tap into. Our administration expenditure, we've estimated at 51 million. But our trend over the last couple of financial years is that we come under the administration expenditure, and we estimate capital expenditure of just under R1 million. Then to actually have a look at our discretionary, what have we budgeted for in terms of discretionary spending, which is most important. And these items are actually in our business plan, as mentioned by our CEO. So our projected discretionary grant income is about 178 million. So that takes into account various elements. So any surplus from mandatory grants, our interest income, our reserves, and so forth. So it's a couple of elements, and I'll show you that in another slide. But our discretionary funding for 2010-11, we are supporting learnerships, about 15 million on the 2.8 target, 4.1 learnerships, 26 million. So there's quite a lot of money set aside for learnerships. Bursaries, 3.7 million. Levy exempt sector, we support that sector to the amount of 7 million. BEE, 1.5 million. ABET, 4 million. Workplace experience grants, 3.1 million. New venture creation, 9.7 million. And then basically based on those items, most of that income that I've just most of that expenditure I've just mentioned now supports unemployed and youth. So for instance, our learnerships, we have estimated that about 80% of our learnerships goes towards youth and unemployed. And then, naturally, learnerships and workplace experience and ABET, as well as our new venture creation project, is also targeted at the youth and unemployed. We have some ETQA projects of 15.9 million, and then we have some research projects, and there's a couple of million set aside there. And then you have also set aside, again this year, 16 million rand for the government layoff scheme. And that's quite important to us as well. And that then leaves us with an estimated surplus of about 59 million. And this slide just shows you what is happening in our reserves. So our discretionary reserves at the end of this last financial year that has just passed is about 312 million rand. We have committed 215 million rand of that. So it's about a 68% commitment on those reserves. Then I have indicated where we're going to get additional funding in the 2010-11 year. So for instance, from our SDL levy income, our interest on our cash reserves, and also mandatory grants that aren't fully utilized. And then how we're actually going to spend that is we've actually also earmarked some additional projects for the 2010-11 financial year. So we've implemented a voucher system. That's also a system where the smaller employer can tap into training. So that also then is what we are doing on the ground to actually get down to the smaller employer. Our Skills for Care projects, we've actually earmarked a couple of exciting projects that will also transform the sectors. Our National Certificate Vocational, 3.5 million, and our new venture creation, that's been a very successful project for us. So we have allocated additional funding in the 10-11 financial year to support youth and unemployed in that area. And then we've also identified some more funds available for learnerships. And then our training layoff scheme, so we estimate that by the end of 2010-11 financial year, we would have reserves of about 60 million left.
Mr. Chairman, just two comments on the financials that the CFO has made that requires a bit elaboration. I think she also mentioned, she mentioned to you that our admin expenditure was less than budgeted, and it was by design, not by default. We implemented some austerity measures as a result of the economic downturn in South Africa, and we then forced our employees to be more conscious of what they spend on and how much they spend in terms of admin. Then you'll see the 59 million estimated reserves for March 31. A significant proportion of that 56 million is money that we've taken back from the provinces because they're not spending their commitments. We made, I think, 35 to 37 million rand commitments to provinces where they did not roll out the projects that they intended to roll out, and at the end of the year we had to pull that money back so that we can reinvest it in other projects. So I thought I must mention to you that it remains a problem for some of the provinces to actually roll out projects that they initially apply for and then do not bring to fruition. In terms of our SWOT analysis, remember we were asked to look at our strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. In terms of our strengths, at the board workshop, we identified that the first strength that we wanted to highlight was our internal leadership was quite strong. We had unqualified audit reports now for 2 years in a row, and the CFO is quite convinced that this year we will end up with a third year of unqualified reports. We have financial stability. We are going concern. Our income and our reserves are well protected and spent. We have good, strong legislative compliance, good stakeholder support, good governance structures are in place, support, audit committee, internal audit, external audit. We're doing well with that. We achieve our targets, and then we have good internal business processes to make sure that we deliver on our business plan and budget. And then finally, our staff are well-trained and developed throughout the year. In terms of weaknesses, as in most cases, as in most CETAs, we unfortunately have this tendency to work in silos, and it's a continuous effort to get managers to look across the fence to what these colleagues are doing. We have difficulty to fill vacancies quickly, and unfortunately, even now, you know, with uncertainty around the CETA landscape, quite a number of vacancies are at the moment not filled. And we hope to secure fill those positions as quickly as possible in the near future. Then one of the weaknesses that we had in the last year or so was that managers are slow to install a progress monitoring culture. Generally managers are supposed to be looking at the numbers, are they achieving their targets, and so on. And it's a culture that we continue to enhance and to enforce that we must monitor our progress and we must make sure that we meet our targets. And as a result of that, commitment failures sometimes occur. You know, we would say we do something, and then in two or three cases, we unfortunately weren't able to do that. Document control issues. Internally in our admin, we are busy working on a document control system at the moment that will hopefully deliver or to reduce the document control issues that we have. And then, of course, we need to improve our customer care focus. Even though we have good customer support, we must consistently and continuously work on that. Opportunities that's out there. Provincial presence could be strengthened. We have three provincial offices at the moment. We're working towards a fourth one in Polokwane. We have one in the Western Cape. We have one in East London, one in KwaZulu-Natal, Durban. And we're working towards a fourth one before the end of the year in the Polokwane area. We need to measure the impact of our projects on people's lives. And for that reason, we introduced a RIME division. The The RIME stands for Research, Information, Monitoring and Evaluation. And this unit now focuses on making sure that we get an unbiased view of how we impact or how the projects that we deliver impact on people's lives. We need to benchmark against other businesses, management and CETAs. We must utilize special funding more effectively, even though I said to you we've got 59 million rand. It bothers us that we had to take 34 million back as a result of non-delivery. We need to build on our positive stakeholder perceptions, focus on the development of the subsectors, the underdeveloped subsectors, and here I'm thinking of emergency care, dentistry, pharmacy, and so on. And then we need to improve our branding and marketing, making sure that the ACCTA is recognized in the marketplace. Threats. Of course, until up to recently, the CETA landscape was a concern. We moved to the new ministry in November last year. We were concerned about a top-down approach with the NSDS3 targets, but I must say that we are delighted with the approach being followed at present, and we are quite keen to participate actively in the NSDS target setting process. We have a high expectation of general public. Another threat that concerns us is that the public in general have a high expectation to have access to our funding and funding opportunities, and we need to make sure that that expectation has been addressed properly. And then, of course, the impact of the economic downturn and the slow upturn that's following, we need to keep our eye on that and be careful how we spend our money, both administratively and discretionary. And then there's always a threat within any CETA of undetected stakeholder fraudulent activities. We are not aware of any of that at the present moment, but we keep our eye, it's on our horizon, and through our internal audit and our fraud hotline and so on, we make sure that we advertise the opportunities for stakeholders to whistleblow should any of that occur. Just to go into the provincial support and the projects that we deliver, Abbott, of course, is one of the first ones that we look at. You can see that there's a significant involvement or number of learners in Abbott Level 4 in the KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng region, some in the Northern Cape, some in the Western Cape. But the other provinces are not really participating as freely as they should. And this theme of the provinces not participating equally, you will see right through all our slides. It's unfortunately one of the things that we are greatly concerned with at the moment, and we need to find a way of making it participation more even. If you look at our levy-exempt function, funding, again, Gauteng, Limpopo taking a huge chunk of it, and then KwaZulu-Natal in the Western Cape will receive most of that funding. Our skills programs, if you look at the DOC bar, or the DOC silo is the unemployed, and then, of course, the lighter one is the employed learners. You can see KwaZulu-Natal, Gauteng, and the Northern Cape, with the Western Cape just behind them, absorbing most of that funding. Number of learners per province, in terms of interns, Gauteng, KwaZulu-Natal, Western Cape. You can see the other provinces are 1-1, 2-2, 1. It's really uneven distribution. Work experience grant, which we assist learners from the world of university or tertiary education into the world of work. Gauteng and KwaZulu-Natal, the bulk of the funding. Provincial support in terms of sustainable new ventures. Number of learners registered, 447, and 214 of them are still in operation 12 months after they completed their learning. This number is slightly lower than we anticipated, and unfortunately, you know, if you asked me 3 months ago, that number would have been higher. But it looks to me like these new venture creations are okay in the first quarter, okay in the second quarter, okay in the third quarter, but the fourth quarter is where the real crunch comes for them, and unfortunately, in this case, it shows on our numbers. Just to talk about learnerships quickly, you will see the split of employed unemployed, 1,862 employed learners against 2,300 unemployed learners, with a total of 4,000 learners in total. The equity split male, female, 3,300 against 800 males. You can see significantly more women. And you must remember why that is. We're in the health and welfare sector, so nursing and that type of occupation carries a high female ratio, and that explains the high number in that regard. Special funding. We have a special funding window that we open once a year, and you can see again on the Western Cape taking a significant proportion of our special funding, and then organizations with a national spread taking the second highest, and specifically in the social development world, in the welfare world, and then of course in Gauteng. What we call the IPAP, Industrial Policy Action Plan projects. We have quite a number of them. We have a maths and science project where we are giving youngsters a second chance through the FET colleges. We've got the early childhood development project. We've got a bursary project at FET level. And then we've got the unemployed graduates, again, taking unemployed graduates from the world of university into the world of work. And you can again see the spread, Eastern Cape, 200 maths and science learners, KwaZulu-Natal, 485 maths and science learners. And then the biggest other one is the, get my colors right, I'm off colorblind. The bursaries here in KwaZulu-Natal are 250, and Northern Cape are 253, and Western Cape are 272. Learner profile in terms of age, the employed learners, you can see a significant proportion of the employed learners are younger than 35, 2,000 of them. And then, of course, the unemployed, 2,600, were less than 35. So just about all our learners are young learners. Employment equity. There was a question around employment equity in senior management. You'll see that the employment equity profile shows that 5% of our senior management are African, zero colored, 1% Indian, 2% white, giving a total percentage of 9. Our management just below us, 2% African, 2% Indian, 1% white, giving us 7%. And then our staff profile, 6% African, 12% colored, 2% Indian, 7% white, and giving us 83. We have one disabled employee in our service, and we are currently also introducing a disabled intern or interns with disability, let me get that right, a project to significantly increase our disability profile in our offices. That's just a slide present, a graph of the equity, the management, and then the staff. And then, of course, the question was asked about the board. We have 26 board members in total, 12 representing employers, 12 representing labor, one representing the Forum of Statutory Councils, and one representing the levy-exempt sector. And again, you will see that we have a good spread of board members, white, African, colored, and disabled, as well as male, female. The board, in fact, is well represented in terms of the EE. There was a question around training provider analysis, whether we are supporting BEE companies. And you'll see, Mr. Chairman, that we have providers in all the provinces, some more than others, and that 167 of our providers are BEE companies, and 106 of them are non-BEE. So we are working towards the BEE ratio.
So I'm sorry to interrupt, so if I may. Your board, you have a board of 26. Are they paid? How much are they paid?
They get an allowance for attending the board meeting, and then they will also claim for travel and accommodation should it be required of them to sleep over or to drive to the meeting. If my memory serves me correctly, I think it's 1,600 rand per board meeting. I've spoken about the BEE. And then training provider cost analysis. We do not fund training providers directly. The ACCTA fund employers. We work with our employers exclusively, except in two cases where we funded two providers for our ISOE project at the value of about 255,000 rand, and then new venture creation project 591,000 rand. But as a rule, we would not be involved with funding of providers. The employer will get the money. He will have established a relationship with the provider, and he will then pay that provider for the services delivered by the provider. Mr. Chairman, those are the questions that we've prepared for. If there are any others, we're more than willing to answer them.
Deputy Chairperson, any word from yourself? Yeah, you can use.
No, Chair, except perhaps to just put emphasis on the issue of mandatory grants, where employers, some of our employers seem to comply with the law and actually don't work in the spirit of the Skills Development Act, that when you submit WSP, you actually train your employees, but they're more in compliance with the law. It's a challenge that the CEO and his team are taking up. That I would wanted to add, Chair. Thank you.
Good. Let me then thank the presenters. Just before the we allow for questions, I think what we are saying is, members, the also to the CEO and the CFO and the Deputy Chair, and convey our gratitude to the Chairperson as well. There was a turnaround strategy in this particular CETA in the last 3 years that at some stage qualifications, the last 2 years they don't have qualifications, etc., and also unqualified reports. So it is, and no disclaimers, so it is in good hands. Secondly, they did submit a detailed report, apart from the high level, because this is not asking all the questions in the questionnaire, but they did submit the report, and also thank you for suggested other questions to be asked, meaning it's more kind of strategic management questions, because that will now further strengthen our ability on oversight and drilling down. So really thank you for that. Members, what we can clearly see is there's good spend. There is a provincial concern outlined at two levels. The one is allocations being moved, and unlike in the National Skills Fund, members, if you can remember, where the NSF say if they send it to a province, they can't really help whatever happens at that level. So even if there is not, because we were asking that question, but after 3 or 4 years of that regional business plan submitted, isn't there some analysis to say, but really, that was possibly in a period where a letter was sent from an NSF office or from the department's office, and suddenly everyone scrambled for business plans, etc. They then submitted it, but possibly half of them is not really there. So that's why after 3 to 4 years, 50% of that particular allocations, provincial allocations, wasn't spent. So we've picked up a more reactive approach and not a proactive approach. Here we've seen at the end of the financial year, or as they're moving to the end, they then identify which provinces, for example, are not spending, and then rather pull back and then reallocate. So I think there is a different approach. The strength of that approach is you do exactly that, what's good accounting is for. The downside of that approach is possibly in that weaker provinces, where most probably the systems, the support, the administration, where a department has turned around 7 times the HOD in the last 5 years or 2 years, and therefore there's no level of consistency, where the skills development facilitator move every 6 months. You understand what? So hence, the concern in that you find, not necessarily related to that unspent provincial, but it's systemic then in nature. It throws certain provinces up that are actually the ones that benefiting from the bulk of this, for the bulk of this particular fund in terms of health and welfare, and the majority of the provinces not getting it. And is there therefore a relation between the provinces that receive it and the more capacitated provinces? Differently put, urban provinces. Is there a link between the money not going to certain provinces, whether it's ABID or other type of projects, and the rural provinces? We actually do require much more clinics, much more social development outlets, and therefore the link of community, health workers, community, social workers, etc. That's the strength of this type of depth of questioning. I think what we are seeing in the management of it, good management structures, again, good even employment equity status in terms of what we are starting to see here, and I'm hopefully that will be the trend in every CETA, and we'll be able to go through that. However, if you start looking at the anchor offices in the CETA, does that also reflect equity? You understand what I'm saying? So all the strategic anchor offices, does it actually start to speak? Who's driving, for example, the real delivery and the real implementation? And those are the hard questions that we'll be interested in. An analysis was made in South Africa that, in fact, if you look at what happened post-94 until, I think, a year or two ago, we've seen a lot of negativity in society at times in terms of the state, but we've seen from the state side a lot of support even to those that were previously advantaged. And how do we actually manage all of those things? And some of us are actually trying to unbundle those real questions at the end. So I think the question that I literally also had, so I thought of interpreting some of the things that was said and putting that out. The success in full-time employment, and even if it is medium-period employment, so as you kind of train these learners, they take up in a sustainable way, and how do you attract them into the future? I think that's a question that I would have. And what is the critical reasons for provinces that not spending, and that's why you have to? You don't need to go per province now. Just what is the three or four critical issues that you've picked up? Those are the two. I made comments, so I just wanted to interpret the stuff. And I'm noting two ends for now, and then I'll allow responses. Member Kubai and Member James.
Thanks, Chair. I think I echo your statements in terms of appreciating the turnaround that is seen from the health and welfare sector. From previous years, it has been marred by a lot of problems. Just to start, I just wanted, in terms of from the financial part of it, there was an issue of a budgeted levy exempt sector. If I can just get more clarity on that one, especially in light, because the my understanding is that the sector has a lot of government entities that fall within this who are exempted from paying the levy. So are you budgeting for this? Just to get a clarity, and maybe I'll come back to it later again. And then the other issue, CEO, would just to understand your staff turnover. In the previous years, it was quite high. Where are you now? Have you reached the point after the turnaround? Have you reached a point where you have stability? Do there are vacancies and understanding the issue of the landscape that could have cost? But do you have, because literally you... The city had a problem of staff turnover for years. People were not staying. There was no stability there. But the other issue that I want to speak about, Chair, it's generally within the cities, and perhaps maybe teaching would also look into this. It's the ability to provide support for employers by either the cities or somebody within the sector for STFs, skills development facilitators in the employer sector, in the employment environment. Because many times you find companies employing individuals. We don't have a training specifically for people who are going to work on this issue within employment. You might have skills development manager, but my understanding is that there was never like a formal qualification you can go and do and say, I want to become a skills development facilitator. And therefore it creates a gap in what they are expected to do. For example, submission of the WSP as the deputy chair saying of the CETA, and the actual implementation of that WSP. So many times we find that the WSP is done as a compliance tool, necessarily just to pass, therefore you've got to do it, this is the time of doing it, submit it, pass, and therefore next time, even when the correlation between that of submission of WSP and the report itself as part of your employment equity and other reports that goes to the Department of Labor. But again, how are we going to find synergy as Department of Higher Education and Training from those that are submitted at Labor? How did we manage to bring that back into correlation with the CETA's work and the employer compliance in terms of legislative requirement? There's a lot of work that we need to do as a committee in terms of legislative framework in reviewing some of the issues. I mean, the issue of surplus, I think we've been hearing it for some time now. But literally, how do you have surplus when we have a crisis nationally of unemployment, and which is said to be caused by skills, lack of skills? So this surplus, how do we find a way? Because my view is that we should not have a surplus, and we can't have a situation whereby you can even project a surplus. My view is to say that we need to have a situation whereby we spend, and this called surplus for me would mean under expenditure in a particular environment. But unless we are able to correct that legislation that says, for example, you can get a qualified from the auditor report when you have a surplus. Therefore, you've got to be able to spend what you have been projecting, what you have been given, allocated, to be able to reflect, you know, good health in terms of your finances. So we have a quite huge challenge. We have a number of young people who are out there who needs this opportunity that we could be able to find. And it goes back to what we've been saying as the committee in terms of bringing synergy between, even when you sit with NSF, saying we don't have the resources in terms of training, you sit with FETs, the problems of even people. How do you find the synergy of getting all this money that is sitting somewhere as surplus channeled to being able to produce what we want to produce as a country, which is skilled labor and skilled young people who can be absorbed by the market? So that's a challenge that we are sitting with as this committee and as well as the sector itself. But other issue, Chair, is around the learnerships that are provided, 15,000 that you are targeting. Just wanted to get the sense of which areas. The last time I checked, you were providing learnership around your health workers, those ones from the health sector side, and then the social development, like your community workers as well, who were going in, like either collecting data and all those things. But there wasn't that attempt to address your scarce skill within the sector much. There was a huge gap when it comes to your learnership. And the issue of a non-response of the sector itself, your employer side, if you've been able to break that, because I remember if you look at, I got shocked at some point that there's something called like your biotechnologist, for example. It's one of the scarce areas. But majority of young people don't know about this area of work, which they could get. But what is the support that you'd be able to provide as a teacher within those areas that are really not known? Either pathology, how do you support those? What do we do in terms of just providing those skills? Even within the working environment, those who have potential to moving from either a biotechnology to a pathologist, for example, how to provide that support to bridge in terms of the scarcity of skills. Because if you look even that sector itself on the scarcity, you find majority of white-dominated people, not really reflecting the demographics of the country. And it's necessarily because as we grow up within our own communities, we don't know about this. But how do we bridge that gap to be able to do? Chair, you pardon me because I just wanted to just raise, I would not come back on this issue. But the other one is to say, perhaps we have a challenge, as you said, as the portfolio committee. How do we bring our own colleagues as well in the provinces? I think we need to find a way of bringing our own colleagues, either in the committees of education in provinces, into a discussion. We can't continue, for example, on ABET. You have zero in Limpopo, Mpumalanga, and Northwest. Limpopo and Mpumalanga are predominantly, even Northwest, known as rural type of provinces, and the level of illiteracy is high in these areas. So I know that it can't be the CETA that goes and says, you know, let's do it. But there's got to be an initiative from the province side to say we're willing to drive this thing. And I think that we've got a responsibility as the committee to be able to push for that. And then I just wanted to understand, lastly, Chair, is the issue of what causes the low uptake of special funding. What are the issues there? What are the challenges? And are we looking at a different way of improving the situation so that we have a 10 in terms of skills development? Thanks, Chair.
Allow responses on those very important questions. So, because remember, we did indicate we're putting enough time per CETA so that we actually get into the details. Now, added to this question, CEO, around the scarce skills and that demographics, et cetera, et cetera. Now we're pumping money and the type of learners, et cetera. Also, how do we actually make sure that we're not pumping the money and after a year and a half, people are actually just, the beneficiaries are the Canadian community, especially in the sector, in the health sector and the welfare sector.
Would you allow me to answer now? Because I think there's quite a lot now, and then I'll go to the next and next. I'm coming back to your comments, first of all. You know, for us, one of the things that I may not have made stressed enough is where we took the money back. Remember I said we took about 37 million rand back. The money, although it comes back to us, we still endeavor to put it back into that province. It doesn't go to another province that's got better utilization. So if we take money away from the Northwest province, for example, I would still have in my mind it must go there, but I must find a way of getting it there. And, you know, it's what they say, the willing partner story. If you get married, your wife must be able to dance with you. You must find somebody in that province that will react positively. I think the comment on the E is very valid because here the two of us are sitting with our white faces. And, Mr. Chairman, I must say it's not by design, it's by default. The CFO was employed before me, and and then I was employed, and I'm sure in a year or two's time the board will make sure that we change that profile. No, we're aware of it, and we take that point. Tracking of the learners is a major issue. And remember I spoke to you about our RIME division, the Research Information Monitoring and Evaluation. And the CFO has pointed out that one of our projects, in fact, is the tracking project, where we have now tasked that unit to find the learners and to write up a report where they are, what happened to them over directly after training, a year later and 2 years later, and so on. And it will be interesting to make those findings known to you, because it will certainly give you sufficient information to say if this is happening in the health and welfare sector, it's probably happening in most sectors, and so on. The levy exempt sector that the member has asked about, you remember the levy exempt are those companies of less than 500,000 that's not paying levy. But they are also still tapping into our reserves and into our projects. We're not, because they're not paying, or we're not holding funds back from them. And we have a specific project where we support the skills development, and it's small companies, NGOs, it's these non-profit organizations, it's 1, 2, 3 type of people. And for that reason, we've actually established a second program now called the Voucher Scheme that we copied from the MERCETA. In fact, we were over a number of years now, have implemented the Voucher Scheme very successfully to give these smaller companies, the 1s and 2s and 3s size companies, an opportunity to train their employees without necessarily spending a lot of their own money on it. It's something that we're looking forward to introduce in the next week.
Because I thought when you were speaking about the levy exempt, it was the government side who have their income as 80% from government. Then those ones, what happens to them? Are you the ones who monitor in terms of their expenditure on that 1% of their total?
The 10% of 1%?
Yes.
Yeah. Those are the government departments that contribute the 30 million that the CFO was talking about. They are, in fact, contributing quite significantly to us. And in fact, they gave us more this year than in past year, so we were happy to accept the additional money. In terms of our staff turnover, we 3 or 4 years ago, the HWCTO was plagued by staff turnover. We had CFO, I think I was the fifth CEO in 3 years. and there was chaos at the top. The board has stabilized. The chairperson, the vice chairperson sitting here, has played a significant role in stabilizing the board. They played a significant role in making sure that the CEO, CFO, and the senior executive managers are stabilized. And we are happy to say that that is now an issue of the past. The CETA landscape, it's unfortunately one of those situations where the best guys are saying, let me jump first, you know, and get out in case there's a problem. But we are well funded and well staffed at the moment. So I'm not too concerned about the vacancies. It's low level vacancies in administrators and so on, that we could easily deal with in future. Support to employers and specifically STFs is a major issue in our world. We know from good experience that STFs there's a high turnover amongst them, first of all. And then, of course, not just in the private sector, but in the public sector as well, STFs play a significant role in our business. And we go out of our way to do workshops with them. In fact, now that we're getting ready for the WSP ATR deadline, the 30 June, we have been holding workshops nationally, inviting them. We, in fact, had special workshops for the public sector. All the provinces, the STFs have been called in. They're well aware of what's expected of them. We're coordinating on a daily basis with them. So I think, to a large extent, that problem would not be that big a problem with us in this year. We've really gone out of our way to work hard to stabilize the STF environment. You spoke about the surplus and the impact. How can we sit with surplus in a time of crisis? We actually don't want the surplus. When I say to my wife I must spend money, she says, let me help you. I can do it at Edgar's in the morning. But if you take the 65 million that I pointed out there, the 16 million of the 65, 56, are training layoff scheme money that's lying idling at the moment. In our sector, not a single company has come forward to apply for the money in the training layoff scheme. We are a sector in need of skills. We're not shredding skills. So the 16 million is lying idle, so that's firstly. And then the 40 million that remains, 37 of that 40 million, in fact, I took back, remember? So I've got our surplus should have been 3 million. And I think 3 million is about as much as you want to risk not having. For that reason, I feel fairly comfortable that we have, in fact, dealt with the crisis effectively. And it's our intention to make sure that even the 56 million, we will probably whittle it down over this next year, down to about 12 to 15 million, and then say, okay, that's what we need as an emergency reserve. You know, you can't go too low at one point. So, Mr. Chairman, other questions?
Can I say that it would be interesting to unbundle further the fact that no opportunities or work was shed in the particular sector. It would be interesting, deeper analysis. Because if one actually just look at cuts, government has cut on social development, just in terms of, as it is, wealth organizations, NGOs, and all of that, and they are, for example, linked with social workers, health workers, etc. So, yeah, it's interesting that you're saying that, just knowing, for example, some of the real cuts that took place.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we in fact are doing research on that. We empirical research. We want to get through the emotional and the antidotal. So we'll when that research report came out, I'm more than happy to share it.
Okay, but we are saying that whilst there, for example, are then funds there on the training layoff scheme, understanding that there is in fact the empirical research. If you actually just take the budgets of the National Department of Social Development and health, and you are actually taking the money where they then had to cut at the level of organizational support. It is money that has gone to NGOs for social workers, meaning health, what do you call it, health community workers, and all of that. And they had to reduce that. That's real. It's not you don't even need to do empirical research from such a, you can do a quick analysis, but not a 6 months analysis to actually find that out. And some of us just know because, I mean, like it's in that space. It has happened in various provinces. But that's one. But I'm suggesting that it's actually important to just reflect on that. We've picked up that training layoff scheme generally. There's money that has not. And I think it's not necessarily the fact that there's not people that were laid off, but it's much more that possibly how that process needs to work. It's a new initiative, so it is that, how does it actually work and how do we get it right? The president has announced it. It's now into the communities, but how's the take-up? I think that's really the issue, and not necessarily if they are. Because everyone starts to speak about the economy is getting better, but reality is there more unemployment has occurred over the last year. We've seen an expansion in that. That's the reality. So it would be interesting if this, if you are saying that this was not necessarily in the sector affected, but the research has to be done, but one doesn't need to do like the six to 10 months research on it. Then on the issue of, I think the notion about employment equity, I mean, like we quite understandable that it speaks to the transformation. As long as people have a transformation mindset, it's really the impact of what you do. It's not always, you know, who you are, but it's that impact, it's that embracing impact of change, of transformation, of ensuring, and then the real issue of what our country's policy perspectives are all on that. So no need to say to be apologetic on that. But the issue really is if you are starting to unbundle all the anchor in a sense mandatory structures in any institutions, what is actually starting to take shape in our society. And I think those are the hard issues, and we, as long as we all embrace that, those questions, it's fine. And that is
Thank you very much, Chair. I've come to the conclusion that Minister Nzamandi has done the absolutely right thing by taking control over the seekers and pulling it towards the center. And now the question is, what is the role of provinces in this? Because clearly the provinces have, in many respects, failed. And the failure is, it's not your failure, it's the failure of governance. And it's an inability to organize a demand in, for example, the Eastern Cape, in, say, having a provincial chamber of commerce, since you fund industry, which is a question, actually, that I would like to ask you why. Who decided that? Why don't you give money to trade unions and so on? That's a side question. Is that the inability to organize the demand, which is clearly there, the need's there. There's a great need for nurses in the Eastern Cape. And how does one help provinces actually organize the demand properly so that they can, in fact, absorb that money? Now, the logic behind the seat is actually it's a compelling redistributive logic, because if you let companies in the private sector spend money on training, they spend it on their own needs. I mean, that's how they work. So if you want companies to contribute to the national need, then you create a seat system. So government has been very creative. They put a mechanism together to generate the funds. They give the funds to you, and your job is to move that money, to take as little of it as possible, to have an efficient organization that can turn around projects very quickly and efficiently and get the money to where it's needed. And the need, it's not to solve the unemployment problem, although it's connected. It is to train and educate our nation. That's what it's supposed to do. And that will have knock-on positive consequences on unemployment level. So that's the logic of it. And when you sit with a surplus, then it's not working. And there's a history to this. I mean, the history of this CETA is not a good history at all. I mean, you have turbulence that goes back to turnaround in terms of senior executives. I asked you the question about how much you pay board members. And if you have an unscheduled series of board meetings, I see there's sometimes it's 12 a year, you know, board members have a fiduciary interest in having as many board meetings as possible because they earn more money that way. As in terms of governance principles, it's highly unsound to have that. So there's a history of actually bad governance in this CETA, and you've gone through your turnaround project. And I really wish you well, but something has really gone wrong here, because what's supposed to happen is that this money, and you cash flush, is supposed to end up in terms of training in a measurable way our young people, and in particular areas, and it's just not happening. And you know, presently you say, you know, it's the province's problem, and I can see that, and it's not your problem, in fact. as a funder. So there's something wrong in the actual system. And so we would like to work towards fixing this and contributing to fixing that problem. My very concrete question is, what is the size of that surplus exactly? Is it 56 million?
Yeah.
So you have to move 56 million in the next financial year? And who decides that? I mean, it's very hard. I mean, you sit with all the discretionary money. I mean, are there limits? Are there schedules of authority? Who approves of what? I mean, I sat on the board of Sunlam. There's no way we would leave a CEO with 56 million rand with discretionary money.
Yeah, not my discretion.
Yeah, but I understand that. But there has to be a responsible way of actually moving that money, and I don't understand how that's done.
Yeah.
So my question is, what is the actual surplus? You have to spend it by when, and how do you spend that money?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Mr. Chairman, let me just start with the first part of that question, where the member spoke about the role of the provinces and so on. I think I'm taking comfort in the development of the new NSTS3. It should give all of us comfort because the minister has made it very clear, and the DGs that sit here has made sure that the NSTS3 framework that certainly reached us has a very specific focus on government priorities. Sectoral and other priorities, and then more importantly, we will not get that document signed off by the National HR Council, where the Deputy President is sitting, unless we have spoken to the provinces. It's an upfront requirement that I'm very aware of right now, that whatever happens to our NSDS, if I do not get the buy-in from the provinces, nothing will happen. So I think it was a brilliant move, and I must congratulate the minister and all his officials with that regard. It should give you great comfort that the thing is going in the right direction. With regard to our surplus, the surplus is 56 million, but we have to spend a lot more before the end of next year. Before the end of March, we will have to spend the normal allocation of funding, which is, I think, 178 million, if I'm correct, Elaine. Sorry, 77 plus 25, let's say 100 million plus then that leaves us then with 56 million. So, in fact, we have 156 million to spend. 100 million has been earmarked, 56 million is now available. Now, the way we do deal with it is it's not the CEO discretion. We have a very specific structure. We use what we call an expression of interest. We make the expression of interest known to the public, to our STFs, everybody else. They apply for very specific learnership skills programs, work experience grant, internships, and so on. And then, amongst others, the special funding window, where we make available funding that's not necessarily linked to learnerships or skills programs or so on. Now, this member actually asked about that, and I forgot to answer it. But what happens is that when you get to the special funding window monies, one of the key criteria that an employer must meet is, firstly, is he addressing scarce skills? And secondly, he must be able to show me that he will have an exit strategy for those learners that he's training. He must show me up front, before he gets the money, that he knows where he's going to put those learners and employ them. And not if he doesn't employ them or he has no intention of employing them, I'm certainly not going to give him the money. But when I say me, it's my organization. We have a governance structure that monitors the applications, that monitors the decision-making surrounding the allocation of that funding, and then it becomes part of the board monitoring as well. The board will monitor whether I've allocated the money sufficiently and correctly and so on, and it becomes part of our internal audit and so on. So there are mega controls in place to make sure that it's not one individual that can influence allocations. And certainly, myself as CEO, I distance myself from the process. I'm actually one of the inspectors making sure that whoever is dealing with that process is doing it correctly.
Did you want to say anything, CFO? About you?
Yeah.
Thank you. Also, just to highlight that part of our surplus is because we have surplus from administration. So, in other words, we are underspending on the monies allocated to us for administration. And we're actually proud of that fact that we are coming under, because then it allows further money to be utilized for discretionary funding.
Shall I take the second round. I'm a bit disadvantaged from sitting. The chair will be back. I'll start with Honorable Gina. We'll come to Honorable Lekhetso in that order. And then Honorable Mbojan. Shall we take, are those the hands that I noted? No? Oh, okay, sorry. You'll come first before Honorable Mbojan. Okay, so that we come this way. Is that okay? Oh, sorry. Shall we start, Honorable Gina?
Okay, thank you, Jefferson. Yeah, I was also concerned, Jefferson, about the usage of this discretionary grant, but a little bit of it, I've just got the response, though I don't think it got where I wanted it to go. It's to say, I understand the mandatory grants from the WSP and how do you use this discretionary one and how far does it go and when and how. I think it's quite important. Another thing, Chairperson, I would be happy if ever I can get from the SWOT analysis that they've come up with, the provincial presence should be strengthened. As to say, how are they, how do you intend strengthening the presence of the province? But because that is where we need to see these things happening. Really, the plan, the whole plan as to how are you going to do it. I hear what Honorable Kubaye said is the role that you should play again as this portfolio committee, but really as the city, as the board, if ever we can get a sense of it as to how do you intend strengthening that. And lastly, Chairperson, I'm a little bit worried about what I read from here, as to say, if ever we read from this flyer, as to say, there was the announcement was a surprise to the city, as to say, I can be happy to get their involvement in the whole thing of this new landscape and what is their comment. For me to read as if it was a surprise for them, whereas they are working with this thing, I can interpret it in so many other ways. As to say, are they why are they surprised? Were they not part of the whole thing? If not, what is their feel around the whole issue? I can be glad if I can hear that.
Thank you, Chair. One of your mandate is to identify shortage of skill in the sector, but the uneven distribution of funds suggests something to me, that you sit in your offices, wait for the application. There is no identification, because your table shows that two provinces gets more than the rest of the funding. So you need to do something. You're on the ground, you represent this committee. We don't have to call you and ask you these questions. You see better, a better position, and you do something on that. Your staff complement, I haven't heard exactly what is your staff complement. They're talking about filling up the vacancies, you know, and you say these are your challenges in the near future. The near future does not make any meaning to me. I hope that can be prioritized. When we meet again, tell us that you have filled your vacancies. Thank you, Chair.
Member Dikoto.
Thank you very much. Just a comment on, again, related to the issue of vacancies. I wanted to know what percentage does this vacancy list present. And for me, it comes from the fact that you have an organogram, you did stretch planning, you knew what your deliverables were, you had an organogram, but then you don't fill it. How does it affect service delivery? I just want to know that, because for me, if it doesn't affect service delivery, it means you did not need those posts in the first place. But also just, I guess if a doctor were to give a prescription to a patient and say you must take 20 tablets, and then at the end there is surplus, it can only mean the patient was not taking his medication. And so the person can't be healthy. So just to understand this, the admin part, to say, why do we have vacancies? What percentage are they? The second one is the on your threats. You're mentioning undetected stakeholder fraudulent activities. Your hotline, what feedback are you getting? Is it busy? Are you getting indications? What follow-ups have been made? Because at times people may just feel that there is no credibility in that, particularly if it's located within the organization. Where is it located? What kind of feedback are you getting? The next one relates to somewhere you're showing special funding, and in your slides you showed provinces, and you had a 10th province called national. If you say this is what we have done, province, we have 9 provinces, and then why national? Because national, in my view, should be the total that you got from the provinces, because there is no 10th province called national. The board, 26, I think my understanding is that this is the outgoing board of 26 members. What is the new size, and what are your views in terms of the ability of that number, whatever it is, to deliver quality service as an organization? And lastly, something has been said about tracking of learners' placements. I'm interested in this group of new venture creations. My understanding is that these people must go and establish own businesses. What follow-up are we making? Are these businesses being organized, arranged? How successful are they? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me take this opportunity to thank the two presenters for a good presentation. Although the majority of your slides are not reader friendly, even with the spectacles. On page 3, slide 2, your discretionary grant expenditure exceeded the budget of for the year. Can the CEO elaborate on that so as to make it clear as to what caused that to happen? And what qualifies one province to receive a huge chunk of budget than the other, as in the case of Limpopo and Gauteng? The other question is, how long does it take for your trainees, your learners, to actually get employment? And are those permanent jobs or casual jobs? And on the provinces that do not use the budgets, is it due to ignorance of the availability of the funds or their reluctance to skill the people? Would you say perhaps the committee should take it upon their shoulders now to engage on awareness campaign in those provinces, even if it goes to ramming it down their throats for the sake of the people in those, poor people in those provinces? Thank you.
Can you also at the end just respond, because that will then be any final comments from your side, but also just any quick responses. You've already responded to the draft, and is there any critical issues that you want to highlight to us as well?
Which
in is this? In is this?
Mr. Chairman, I've got quite a number of comments made out, so I'll deal some of them simultaneously or close to each other. In terms of the SWOT analysis, the provincial presence, and how do we allow that to happen? The uneven distribution of the funding and the learners and so on. We actually, for that reason, strengthened our presence in the various provinces, and we will continue to strengthen our presence in the provinces now that we have a mandate or a possible mandate for the next 5 years. We know that there are capacity problems within the provincial structures, and we are anticipating that upfront and the new officers as well as the existing officers are going out of their way to establish the relationships and networks and so on with the various provincial officials involved with the application of funding and the utilization of the funding. Because you must remember the money that we distribute is done on what I call on paper. If you apply for funding, there must be a memorandum of understanding or a service level agreement, and then you must honor the principles stipulated in that service level agreement. If you don't, then the CFO will not release the money. So he will just say, you're not meeting the criteria, and I'm bound by the PFMA and Treasury regulations and the Auditor General of South Africa, and therefore the money stops here. And that's actually where the bottleneck comes in. One of the members asked what's causing the bottleneck. It's the rollout of the funds based on the go no go conditions of the service level agreement. The question around the new landscape and the surprise. Although we were involved in some of the research that were done in the last year or two, I mean there was NetLAC research done. There were quite a number of GTZ research papers and various other individual research papers done by the Department of Labor and so on. We were not party to the actual decision on how the CETAs will be split. I assume that it was done at the new Department of Higher Education and Training, and they used the research reports that were available to them at the time. So in that regard, it came as a surprise to us when the minister announced the new landscape, and certainly that our CETA would then be split into the health component and the social development go to another component.
If you'll just allow, Chairperson, I think that the committee may not be aware that the process is this of consultation. It's not announced. It's announced for consultation.
Yeah.
So there's no decision being made, and part of the process is to consider views of the CETA.
Yeah, and I must say, the GDA is correct. We are in the process of making presentations. There's a deadline of the 31st of May where our consultation document must be in. And then around about the 17th to the 19th of June, we will be asked to make formal presentations. So we're happy to participate in that. In terms of the shortage of skills, we in fact have identified the shortage of skills in our sector. There's a booklet in your pack. If you let me just give me that one. Yeah, that little one clearly is there. It's based on our sector skills plan. Chapter 3 of our sector skills plan says identify your scarce and critical skills. The scarce skills have been identified. We've communicated that with the department. We're making sure that we communicate it to all employers, public and private, that these are the scarce skills that's available, that's required in our sector. And our funding is directed at scarce skills. We will not support funding. We will not support learning that's not directed at scarce skills. So that document is actually far more important than the little size of it. There was a question around staff complement. Why are we filling them? The holdup was in fact mechanistic, in that our license were expired on the 31st of March 2010. The minister then extended our license for a year to March 2011. And against that background, you know, you're nervous to appoint a young man or a young woman in a permanent position, and then if you're not too sure if your license will be renewed, will you be able to employ that person? And myself and my colleagues are all on contracts that expired on the 31st of March, but it's been extended to the 31st of March next year. So based on that, you just need to be careful. You know, we can't just appoint people and then 6 months later say, oops, I must now retrench you again. So we were a bit reluctant to just take on people, and we made do with the staff that we had. There were service delivery problems, I will not deny that. But in the end, I think if you look at our annual report that we're busy drafting right now, we actually had once again a really good year in the HWC. So we're quite proud of our results as a result of our hard work. It'll be about 9 or 10. It'll be low level. It'll be in the administrator and clock type environment. Most of the senior positions, in fact, were stable. Then there was the question around the undetected fraud. It is something that every single CETA and board member are concerned about. You know, if you do not detect the fraud, and it jumps out through the Mail and Guardian or wherever. So we're always aware of it. We have a fraud hotline. It's a fraud hotline dealt with outside of our organization. The numbers are freely available, and in fact, the fraud hotline is working. We have, I think, about 13 or 14 cases right now that we're investigating. Now, I'm happy to say all of those cases are external to the CETA. It's not as a result of staff fraud, but it is a case where learners and parents and so on complain about a provider who may be doing something wrong. He's charging students for, you know, he's getting funds from us and he's charging students, or he's getting funds from us and he's using our name incorrectly or gives certificates for which he hasn't got a scope or so on and so on. And we have a legal advisor, Ms. Kahile, who then deals with it. She, in fact, this last week we're in Cape Town dealing with 3 or 4 of those cases. I think of the 14, about 7 of them are criminal cases which we've reported to the SAP. And they are being dealt with in a criminal fashion. So the hotline is certainly working for us very well. Every single forum, every single encounter, you will find our hotline number on the table. The national, the province number 10 national, unfortunately, oh, no, I shouldn't apologize, quite a number of our employers and service delivery organizations have a national spread. They will be serving 5, 6, 7 provinces. They're not necessarily linked to Gauteng or KZN or wherever. And for that reason, we put them as national, because you wouldn't know where to put them in a province. They serve all the provinces. So I take your point, and in the future, perhaps we must be more careful and then make sure that we don't create that impression of a dense province. The board has 26 members. It's an outgoing board. They will complete their service at the end of March 2011. They've also been extended as a result of the license extension. The board has operated well in the last year, 2 years that I've been involved with them. They certainly have gone out of their way to assist us with workshop, strategic planning, business planning, and process rejuvenation. And when we go into the new cycle, we will go through, our constitution has very specific measures how you will go about establishing a new board. It's upon the CEO. The constitution calls upon the CEO to put notices out, to get the nominations in, to establish the mechanisms that will finally appoint these board members, and then the minister will sign off on the chairperson of the board. The tracking of the learners of the NVC, National Certificate of New Venture Creation, sorry, I've got the wrong one now. We, in fact, have signed the MOU of CEDA, a small enterprise development agency of the DTI, and they are assisting us with the continuous support of these learners past the initial training. We give them the 6-month training, they go into the field, and CEDA then becomes a handheld agency that will guide these learners into establishing their businesses properly. And as I pointed out, the first 9 months where they were doing well, this last quarter we had a bit of a drop-off. We've reported it to CEDA. We're working on finding ways to bring those youngsters back into the business and they can not become lost to the opportunity. And we certainly think that CEDA is doing a wonderful job. I reported to their CEO and board the other day, and we were delighted with the support that we get from CEDA to support these youngsters. There was a question around the discretionary grant that it exceeded. The what the CFO has pointed out there, Mr. Chairman, is that we have for the first time spent more money than what we planned to spend on discretionary grants. So in other words, we were eating into that reserve that everybody is concerned about, and which is exactly what we want. We want to reduce that, and we've exceeded about 36 or 38 million, if I remember correctly, and we will continue to do that in this year as well. That 56 million is part of that pie that must now be reduced to the lowest possible level. Our learners, when they go through the system and they get trained and certificated, they all take permanent jobs. We don't have temporary jobs. We have labor brokers, specifically in the nursing environment. You will be aware that the nurses have these labor brokers that they, on a 24-hour basis, they will be in and out of an organization based on the labor brokers. But the Department of Health and Social Development, and specifically the Department of Health, has taken very specific decisions to eliminate these labor brokers and to appoint those nurses rather on a permanent position rather than making use of the labor brokers in that environment. And then, Mr. Chairman, my view of the NSDS draft, when we received the DOF, we were delighted with the approach followed. We were impressed with the fact that the NSDS is upfront and critically saying that you must support the government strategies and midterm priorities. We were impressed with the framework that was put forward. We contributed last week to the development of further development of the actual targets and the formulation of those targets, and we were looking forward to dealing with it. One of our main concerns was that it was going to be a top-down approach, and we immediately found that it was not the case. The department is willing to engage with us. They're willing to sit down and discuss these targets and the formulation of the targets, and we are certainly delighted and working quite hard to be part of that process. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I conclude.
Thanks a lot. Let's thank the presenters, including the Deputy Chairperson. The issues that members have raised and some of the obviously follow-up issues will then be communicated. But clearly the question that on that provincial, national issues, an approach of how do we actually bring provinces into a strategic discussion, getting them to be aware of what their responsibilities are. However, if truth needs to be told, reality is provinces were not really, in terms of the mandatory and legal processes, there wasn't really a governance institutional framework that really talked to provinces and national. So one doesn't, it's implicitly that it's now provinces, but at the end of the day, there was money that was sent, but everyone just did their own little way and how it was done, etc. So I think just back to Member James, just the notion about provinces and provinces essentially didn't add any mandatory link to the CITES individually, and CITES could have gone in and do their own thing, etc. So if they speak provinces, it doesn't necessarily mean the process via a provincial government structure or department at times. In your case, yes, in OCTs at times directly linked to industries and community structures and so on. But that's an area that we need to be able to clean up and into the future. I think the question of scarce skills, critically an issue of us, and you're ducking the response on retention. So it would be interesting to get a particular just response, not now, but in a sense in writing. In terms of that, the learners, that's the scarce skills, learners that were trained, and what actually is happening to them, and where are they? And what is the analysis about how many are actually leaving the country? Not because they want to leave the country for the sake of just leaving the country, because there's recruitment agencies all over this world vying for health, and so nurses, social workers, as well as teachers, etc., and engineers. I think the issue around just the training layoff process and your process around that and supporting it. So members, let's excuse the CITA. I'm seeing your hand, but unless it is, as this call came in earlier, it's
just an answered question, if I may. Who decided that you only give money to companies?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, when I say we give money to employers, we mean whether it's a government department, a public, private, and even a union. How would is an employer of the members, and they will ask for money for a project that will improve their members. So it's employers in the two sense, whatever services you provide.
Okay. Let's thank the CEO, and thank you for making time to be here, and also to the CFO as well as to the Deputy Chairperson. We will now request Mercy to come forward, and I actually shouldn't have allowed Mercy to sit in the session earlier. It would be very interesting to hear to just hear this kind of responses. Thanks. Let me welcome the chairperson and the CEO and give them, so they can actually present the team as well as the content.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairperson. DG, honorable members, everyone else that is here, I am the Chairperson of the Mashita Governing Board. My name is Jani Esterhazy. Next to me is the CEO, Dr. Raymond Patel. Deputy Chair on my right-hand side is Kalani Chayana. I represent RMI employers. Kalani represents NUMSA from labor side. Down the line there is Mr. Tom Gwanazi, the Corporate Governance Manager. Behind me is Mr. Wayne Adams, the Chief Operations Officer, and Bula Ziruni. Down there is our Chief Financial Officer. The mandate of Mashita is to develop the skill of the South African workforce to improve the quality of life of workers, their prospects, and work and labor mobility, to improve productivity in the workplace and the competitiveness of employers, also to promote self-employment and to improve the delivery of social services, meaning reducing unemployment and improving literacy in South Africa. Also to increase the levels of investment in education and training in the labor market and to improve the return on that investment. Furthermore, to encourage employers to use the workplace as an active learning environment, to provide employees with opportunities to acquire new skills, to provide opportunities for new entrants to the labor market to gain work experience, and to employ persons who find it difficult to be employed. Also to encourage workers to participate in learnership and other training programs, to improve the employment prospects of persons previously disadvantaged by unfair discrimination, and to redress those disadvantages through training and education, to ensure the quality of education and training in and for the workplace, to assist work seekers to find work, retrenched workers to re-enter the labor market, employers to find quality employees, especially in the technical fields, and I'll hand over to my deputy chair to tell you what is Mashita.
Good morning, Chair, and to your team as well. We are one of the 23, you know, CETAs established through the Skills Development Act of 1998. Our role is to facilitate skills development for the following subsectors: the metal and engineering, the auto manufacturing, motor retail and component manufacturing, tire manufacturing, and plastics industries. Together, the five subsectors comprise approximately 44,000 companies with a workforce of approximately 600,000. Our vision as Mashita, we want to become leaders in closing the skills gap, and our mission is to facilitate sustainable development of skills, transformation, and accelerate growth in the manufacturing and the related services sector. I will hand over to the CEO. Thank you.
Good morning, Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee, members of Parliament and Department officials, and the DG in particular. Our strengths as an organization, as Mashita, is one that during the past strategy, that's NSDS 1 and NSDS 2, and in particular during NSDS 2, we had huge participation of our industry. Mashita infrastructure and capacity to manage information, we have that. We've shown that over the years that we have a stable management structure. I can say to you, to the members of Parliament, that for the last 3 years, Not a single member of the senior executive management team has left the organization, nor our region, which makes us very stable. We have a provincial presence in every province. We've done sufficiently well in registering qualifications on the NQF, and in particular, number of learnerships registered. We have a tried and tested apprenticeship system. We have modernized that system recently by bringing in the accelerated artisan training program, which I will speak to later. We have a very good cooperation from our chambers and stakeholders and excellent stakeholder support. We have displayed and shown that we have the efficiency of grant disbursement system. More so, we run our business very cost effective. Not once over the last 10 years have we ever gone over our 10% admin fee. We've always stayed underneath that amount. We also have the leadership, or we show leadership within the sector, and in particular in our sector, the manufacturing sector, but also with government, both provincial and national, we've taken on that leadership role. And in doing so, we brought about quite a bit of innovation and the way we deliver the work that we do. Lastly, Chairperson, we are one of the best, or we've been cited as one of the 39 best companies to work for in South Africa. And I think that's a strength. One of the 39 best companies to work for, a survey. That's what we provide to our employees. Right. Our weaknesses, and we accept, as Confucius says, he knows not that he knows not. So we know what our weaknesses are. Our limited coordination between DTI and Mercita, and we want to improve that because it is virtually impossible for the Mercita to deliver on skills without DTI's full involvement. We now have somebody sitting on our board as from next board sitting. Our levy system is exploited for financial gain. And I must emphasize that to Parliament, that there are companies who totally set up a training division on Mercita funding, with no funding from them, and that's exploitation. The absence of an effective quality management system. Although we've got a good quality management system, I think that CETAs in the main and in South Africa need an effective quality management system. It is criminal, 10 years later, that we do not have a central database that registers all the learners that we could extract information from. Or employers could go and say, these are the learners I'm looking for, and get that information. So I would speak in as CETAs, not only Mercita. The lifespan of the NSDS, that five-year lifespan, I've heard the colleague speak before, does make planning and retention of skills very difficult. The preparation for a global market. Are we training for a South African market? Are we training for a global market? And I think the space that Mercita plays and the space that South Africa plays in a global economy, that we should be taking up that. And that is a weakness within our systems. Limited skills programs. The delivery of a consistent customer service. I think we should be bureaucrats in business by now and have that skills focus and customer service throughout. The quality service, Mercita succession plan, our learnership progression. The system is so desired, and I'm sure I don't have to tell this committee that people get into there for a 1 year and exit again. And it's not real meaningful skills that are being transferred. At the same time, we get people who go learnership hopping and become professional learners from one CETA to another, and the system does not pick them up. 10 years later, Chairperson, CETAs have achieved a level of success, including Mercita, but we have failed to advocate our successes enough. We don't think that, and that's a weakness within us. The opportunities that present us, Chair, one is the economic growth. Although the economy is not fully recovered, but we believe that the cycle will come, whether it's U, W, V, or whatever, but that economic growth will come, and we need that to have training provided. The human resources development strategy, too, that's being out there, is another opportunity that we as Milsita are looking forward to. The opportunity with the new NSDS3 and more relevant NSDST and the involvement of a sector skills plan, the relevance thereof, and getting industry and communities involved and sign off is a great opportunity for us. The increase in productivity, increasing in our quality services, the infrastructure and network management, infrastructure development. We hear that government speaks of an infrastructure development of over 727 billion rand over the next years, and that would be an opportunity for us. Outsourcing is an empowerment to improve our BEE status, or broad-based black economic empowerment. Our financial incentives for learnerships, the new opportunities highlighted by the Minister of Finance in the budget speech recently. These are opportunities that will increase the number of learners in our sector. Expanding the work of Mercita as the pinnacle or the top artisan-related training CETA. We see the new CETA landscape as that opportunity for us. Threats, Chair, the reality of HIV/AIDS, and even amongst our staff, amongst our learners, is there. That's a great threat for us. Global competitiveness, retrenchments within the sector, the poaching of skills internally amongst CETAs and also within companies. You develop an SDF and suddenly he goes to a company for a few thousand rands more. Externally, to Australia especially, we've seen that. Insufficient delivery of learnerships, the brain drain, lead times, and lastly, CETA landscape. It is a proposal, and we've studied those proposals, but should that happen, it will bring an abrupt end to the smooth running of Mercita over the last 5 years. So here I'm pleading, and the DG, Professor Metcalf, is not here, I would say, please leave the Mercita as it is. Chair, I'm now beginning to answer the questions and to make it very easy for us. In terms of our discretionary grant expenditure, we'll get to our budgets. We first want to show you the expenditure, then show you where the money comes from. We have 748 companies in the Eastern Cape. They contribute 6% of the Mercita levy income. We have spent 9% in that province. We have 485 companies in Free State and the Northern Cape. They contribute 4% of Mercita levy income, and we have spent 8%. We have 52% in Gauteng. Yes. Chair. We have spent 27, or maybe Eastern Cape, too. Our deputy chair comes from the Eastern Cape. In KwaZulu-Natal, we've got 1,822 companies, 14% contribution, and we spend 34% for that province. Mpumalanga, Limpopo, 779 companies, 6% of our levy contribution, and we spend 18%. Western Cape, 18%, and we spend 5%. Now, Chair, I know that question is going to come, so I'm being proactive in answering this. The literacy levels in the Western Cape are the highest in the country. The skills levels in the Western Cape are the highest. So the point I'm beginning to make to you, that why are we spending more in certain provinces where the income is skewed? It's simply that we're beginning to address two key issues. One is poverty and unemployment at the same time, and the second one is beginning to address the issues of illiteracy and innumeracy in these provinces. You just have to see the matric results and they would be reflective of this. Our mandatory grant spend, if you notice that again, it's 9% in the Eastern Cape, whereas their contribution was 7%. So we're beginning to spend a bit more around there or the participation. In total, just going to give you, we've spent 276 million, almost 277 million on mandatory grants. How do we address the issue of need?
Those are young people not in employment or education and training. And we take here, Chair, very clearly the issues addressed by the Minister of Education and the DG of Department of Higher Education and Training. And that is beginning to say, what opportunities do we provide for learners who've exited our system, either premature or at matric level? We say, the Mercy Eater will be spending in excess of 600 million rand on this. It's quite a huge amount. Now, that 600 million is also substituted by an amount of about 65 million rand from the NSF. So the direct spending is 600 minus 65, which gives us 537 million almost. We want to train 2,310 apprentices. We believe that is the one way of getting skills to young people and getting them ready to become an industrious group of people. Our programs are very scarce and critical skills skewed. We make no apology for that because those are the skills and that's what being tasked our mandate is all about. Learnerships, 2,000. New venture creation, 250. Now, we had implemented a successful new venture creation program in NSDS2. And we're very happy that we have trained over 370 people who are continuously tracked. And I must say here, Chair, what we've done with it, we created an internal system. We do not outsource a lot. When I get to our steps, we employ quite a number of people internally to do the tracking and work. Then we've got a thing called incubation. It is taking people and putting them into an incubator by training them into real places, welding, manufacturing, whether it is making a door frame or a burglar bar. They work with huge companies, especially in the Mpumalanga area, with Columbus Steel and so forth, and with the universities of technology, Nelson Mandela in particular. Workplace experience. These are learners who've qualified from the university and the universities of technology, engineers, P1, P2, and that's the amount we want to train there. Graduate trainees. We've also put aside an amount of 13.5 million for NGO, CBO, and co-op support. EBITJ, and we want to probably correct this, in that the Mercita programs, quite innovative over the last 3 years, we've tried, they were on a trial with us, and we piloted them. We introduced what we call business EBIT, accelerated EBIT, and occupational EBIT. I'm sure Professor Wilmot will enjoy this when I say this, that there's a big difference between andragogy and pedagogy. We do not expect adults to learn the same. And I think the systems over the year expected adults to go through a process of appels and clunkers are, which is wrong. We therefore moved and we said, let us take, if you're working in the motor industry, you need not know that cur is for cat, but you need to know that cur is for clutch. And that's how we introduced that program. We spent quite a bit of money. For the first time, and I must say this, for the first time ever since the Mercedes inception, we had over 80% success rate on EBIT learning with this particular program that we introduced. So we're now rolling out what we call adult education and training. Because our business EBIT is not only for people who don't have any literacy and numeracy. If you do not have computer fluency, you're illiterate. And we need to train you to become productive in a business. And that's what we introduced there. The accelerated artisan training program, Chairperson and members, is a program that I think highly unique. We did a review on this program recently, high review with the NBI. It came out as one of the programs, and we'd like to share this report with you if you want. We could send it to you. This report is indicated that through this initiative and the way we've managed it and the systems that we've created, we brought on board the major manufacturers, ArcelorMittal, Tata Steel, who trained here. And we took learners who have qualified from our FETs with a minimum qualification of N3, N4. We accelerate them to an apprenticeship training within 18 months because it is deemed that the foundation and the fundamentals are in place, and all they need is the training in a workplace. And this particular program, we're expanding now with another 575 learners at a cost of 65 million. Passion of the Mercy Eater, we realize that it is virtually impossible to capture learners and to get them into the industry if our pipeline is not feeding it to us. Now, members of the Portfolio Committee on Basic Education will understand what I'm saying. Our math science in our school setup is not delivering yet what we want. And we can't wait to say we'll wait for it. What we're beginning to address here, and another success story, we had a 98.7% success rate of matriculants that went to our math science, maths program, matric program, and succeeded, of which 68% had the equivalent of a matric exemption, getting into university to scale skills. We supported those programs, and these learners, we didn't pick up only in matric. We picked them up from grade 10, and we take them through. We've recently sent a learner from a very disadvantaged background, where the president was recently in Orange Farm, very close to that area. We've taken this learner and we send her to America. She'll be going to America on a math science Olympiad at the cost of Mercy Job to be represented. And she's in grade 10. She's done grade 11. She's done exceptionally well. We don't want to lose her for the system. So we're building and investing skills already. People with disabilities, we do believe that we've got to look at our sheltered factories, especially in collaboration with the Department of Labor, working with them and getting people with disabilities the necessary skills. Our bursary projects, one of our proud projects that we have 420 learners, or we currently have over 550, we're increasing it by 420 now, learners at our universities, universities of technology, studying engineering, scarce skills such as accountancy, chartered accountancy, economics, and so on. Those are the scarce skills. We realize that we can't only say that we're an engineering CETA, we only sponsor people in engineering. We need accountants. We need economists to look at the sector, and that's where we begin. Chairperson, we need not speak much of the next program, the Retrenchment Assistance Program, which branches into two. It's the training layoff scheme, as announced by the president, that we're continuing. We put in last year an amount of 80 million rand. Bula will correct me if I'm not right there. But we've also taken into cognizance that people were already retrenched when government introduced its scheme. So we were part of the training layer scheme, and the first CETA and the greatest contributor to the scheme currently and participant through initiatives of Ford, BMW, and so forth, and a number of steel manufacturers. But we realized people have lost jobs, and we're taking these people and retraining them into other areas of work. And that's through our retrenchment program. Jay, recently, you know, and I must say, I do regard myself as a veteran now in the CETA world. Just spent over 7 years as a CEO in two CETAs. But, you know, it only hit me this year that one of the things we're not doing effectively is we're not providing career guidance last year. That we sit there and we give this money, but yet, and this was when kids were writing to me as CEO, wanting to know what career I follow. And we created what we call a career guidance counseling center within the Mercy Eater. We want to replicate that to us. We'll be starting at the head office now. And we started our first, and the DG was one of the first people that walked to our career center on a very micro scale at our recent conference, where we had trucks, where we had engines there, we had the steel industry, and we had kids coming in buses where we exposed them. And we believe through this visual exposure that kids will become interested in the manufacturing and engineering sector. And I'll give over to Bula, our CFO. I'll stand back.
Good morning, Chairman of the Portfolio Committee, members, and all present. Shown is the budget for 2010-11 as compared to 2009-10 actual. The Mercy Eater has budgeted for a modest increase in the levy income of 2%. At the point of compiling the budget, there were great uncertainties in what was happening in our sectors. But towards the end of the year, this has picked up considerably. 33 million is budgeted to come from the National Skills Fund for our flagship AATP project, and that is shown as government grant income. We have budgeted for 50 million as interest to be received on the investment of our surplus funds. These funds are sitting at banks, and these funds are all committed, or 83% committed, to projects that will continue within 2010, 2011, and beyond. Our full income is budgeted to be almost at the same level as 2009-10. On the mandatory grant, the MSITA has limited its budget to what was there in 2009-10, mainly because the MSITA has no say in what companies incur, which allows them to claim mandatory grants, and therefore cannot be sure that this is aligned with skills and critical skills. The MSITA has budgeted for expanded discretionary grant and project expenditure. The first discretionary grant window opened in April 2010 and has just closed. Most of the expenditure that you'll see for 2010-11 has already been committed. We've signed contracts for it, and the regional officers monitor and evaluate the training that the employers are doing. The MSITA plans to keep the admin costs within the required limits. The MSITA has budgeted for a substantial deficit of 309 million in order to reduce the large reserves that the MSITA currently holds of 850 million within the discretionary grant reserve. Attached is an analysis of the discretionary expenditure 2010-11 budget compared to actual. This is analyzed according to the indicators on our service level agreement that we have with the Department of Higher Education and Training. In most categories, you'll see that the MSITA has budgeted for greatly increased expenditure and a total increase of 37% in total. You'd also see that a lot of the expenditure, 280 million, is going towards training unemployed learners under indicator 4.1. On the graph that shows the various components of income versus mandatory and discretionary grants, one can clearly see how our discretionary grant expenditure has increased in the last 2 years, from 2008-09, 2009-10, and towards the budget for 2010-11. The MSITA's budgeted financial position for March 2010-11 is showed against the last 2 years. The MSITA has substantial cash and investment reserves. As of 31 March 29, there was 969 million, and we plan for that to almost halve to 512 million for 31 March 2011. The MSITA also has substantial reserves at the end of the page. Total reserves, 865 million now, but we plan for those to also reduce down to 565 million. One needs to look at reserves in the light of our commitment. The MSITA has 850 million in discretionary grant reserve as of 31 March 2010, of which 723 million, 83%, is already committed. That means that the MSITA has signed contracts with employers and with providers for how these funds are going to be spent on board-approved projects and training initiatives. The MSITA has long-term programs stretching from 1 to 4 years, and legislation only allows us to commit funds that we already have on hand. So due to the long-term nature of our programs, we'll always have some reserves. The key point to look at is what percentage of those reserves are committed at any one point. Looking at the next graph, one can look at 2008-09, we were 54% committed. 2009-10, we were 70% committed, compared to what we plan now, we will be 83% committed and see that this is moving in a positive direction. The Masita has also large cash reserves, which are kept at 5 A-rated financial institutions, which are Nedbank, RMB, Standard Bank, Investec, and Absa. The Masita takes a risk-averse approach in investing. The security of our funds are paramount. We only invest in deposits or in a call account. We've got an investment committee which oversees the investment function and makes sure that we do not risk our capital in any way. In addition, for the 2010-11 budget, the Masita plans to purchase an office building for about $30 million. This will help us limit our rental expenditure over the next 5 years. This we can only do once we have been re-established and with the approval of National Treasury. Looking at the analysis of 2009 financial performance against budget, our levy income increased by 7%, which we had not planned for. We had planned that the effects of the economic downturn would be quite severe within our sector, but towards the end of the year, it became evident that it was not as bad as we had thought, and there was some recovery within the sector. The interest and penalties are collected by SARS, and we've got no say over this. This is when they penalize people who do not pay their full levy on time. The government grant income of $22 million mainly came from the National Skills Fund for our flagship AATP project, as well as $4 million that came from the training layoff scheme. The interest received is $75 million, which is 7% below our budget of $18 million. We had planned for interest rates to stay above 7% for the whole year, and this dropped towards October, November 2009. Our revenue is 6% above budget at $819 million. On the expenditure side, our mandatory grants are 22% above budget. This is due to the fact that we had a very good response to our call for WSP and ATR submission. The $334 million translates to a 73% claim ratio. That means that 73% of the companies who could have claimed have claimed their mandatory grants. And this is up from the 70% claim ratio that we experienced in 2019. The discretionary grant expenditure is split between discretionary grants and project expenses. In total, this is up by 33%. And this is due to us in total, this is below budget by 33%, but it's up from prior year by also 33%. The Masita experienced some downturn within its sectors, and employers who were facing losses, who were facing retrenchment, were less willing to train at the same levels as they had committed in the previous years. They also delayed training implementation in many cases. Our operational administration costs were kept within the budgeted level and were 3% below budget. The Masita made a deficit of $123 million against a budgeted deficit of $365 million. The deficit has therefore eaten into the large reserves that the Masita holds. On the discretionary grant expenditure, as explained before, a number of the projects and the expenditures did not proceed per plan. However, we managed to make 67% of budget, which in light of the recession is a very good position. The Masita has had 9 years of unqualified audits in a row, and the Masita's discretionary grant expenditure continues to improve. I will now hand over to the Chief Operating Officer, who will continue.
Thank you, Chair. Members of the Portfolio Committee as well as members of the Portfolio Committee of Basic Education. If the next slide basically deals with some of the project initiatives that's currently running within the different provinces. The first one being within this province, the Western Cape, we do have a tooling initiative, which is a special purpose vehicle. And this project deals with training of 25 unemployed learners on a pre-apprenticeship system. And MECETA is currently working with the tooling initiative organization within the province to find placements for the apprentices at relevant companies. I think that's been a challenge for us, the issue around finding placement for some of these learners that comes through our system. The next one is the Cape Town Boat Building Initiative, and what I like about this particular project, it also begin to address the issues of learners with disability. I think there's a strong focus, particularly on deaf learners in this initiative, and we have identified 15 unemployed learners on the small craft construction qualification. One of the other challenges was before these learners were enrolled, we had to deal with the finalization and registration of their particular qualification. It's also a project where we've embarked on a relationship with one of the FET colleges, being Falls Bay, their Westlake campus. Then there's the South African Oil and Gas Initiative, once again a project where approximately 300 unemployed learners have been trained, of whom are not, have been placed. And I think it's once again, I think that's been our biggest challenge, Chair, is to find workplaces for the experiential training of these learners. But we continue to engage with our stakeholders to make sure that these learners do get the required exposure in terms of workplace training. Western Cape, I hope we're not giving a preference to this province. This is a very recent initiative where the CEO attended a summit, Mitchell's Plain summit, and we have committed within the summit to an amount approximately 10 million retrained, 50 to 100 previously retrained workers, 50 learnerships at Cape College of Cape Town and Northlink, 75 learners to attend skills programs, particularly new venture creation, 25 bursaries, as well as 25 learners who would have the opportunity of gaining experiential learning.
Chair, could I ask a question? What is the legal identity of the Mitchell's Plain Summit project?
Differently put, how will it be executed, the project?
What is the legal identity? Or the legal identity of the other recipients, the provincial government, is that a Section 21 company? What is the legal identity of that?
Chair, I hope I'm audible. Am I audible?
Yeah.
The execution of this particular project looks at an area, the first time we're looking geographically. But the execution is only through either the college, as we've taken Cape Town College Northlink as a partner, or through our registered companies that exist within the Western Cape. We also have that's generally the mercy. Now, we do not pay funds to individuals or companies that do not.
Of course you don't. I was just looking after the chair.
It's my constituency. That's the issue. And it's his constituency as well. That's the two parties, same constituency.
The other one is the Beaufort West Provincial Government. I think this is a project in conjunction with the Beaufort West Municipality, where once again we're looking at identifying 45 youth who have passed matric with exemptions, and then obviously as part of our NGO CBO project, we want to ensure that we provide opportunities for these unemployed learners within that particular area of our country. Then we get to the Eastern Cape. The first one is our cooperative agreement with the Nelson Mandela Metropolitan, and there's a number of initiatives that's going to flow from this. One being I think we've in principle agreed to have a rural focus within the Eastern Cape to identify within the Eastern Cape rural areas where we could once again implement a science and meds program within those areas. It's about providing bursaries for the previously disadvantaged learners, worthy learners, of course, and as well as the placement of those learners within industry. The other component of the project is the promotion of women within engineering. I think the engineering sector per se is very male dominated, and we need to find a way to change that particular approach, and I think this is one of the projects that really excites us. The focus also within that particular institution is around the automotive sector. And the automotive sector within the Eastern Cape is quite huge, and we have adopted the NMMU as a partner within that sector who's going to assist us in the rollout of some of our projects. There's also initiative with the Eastern Cape Department of Education as a partner, Mercedes-Benz South Africa, and of course, Mercedes and some of the public institutions, which could be FET colleges. And we want to work closely with the public sector colleges in upgrading the instructor specialist and methodological skills. 20 apprentices is currently undertaking some training, and obviously we hope to increase the numbers as part of that particular initiative. Another initiative is the government layoff scheme. As you know, we are heavily involved and currently are the biggest contributor to the layoff scheme, and it's to assist retrenched workers, and 903 employees tend to benefit from that particular initiative across the Eastern Cape. The Kuga and the Masita initiative through the NSF funds and Masita employees, we have managed to place more and to train more than 200 learners within that particular sector, and the qualification spread from over level 2 to level 4. The National Skills Fund is once again some or all provinces received to the tune of, if I recall correctly, 100 million from the NSF funds. Our contribution is to find, in conjunction with the province, to find workplaces for those learners, and we continue to do so. Moving to KZN, we have a KZN provincial government in Isisa Masita partnership, and we've trained more than 250 apprentices, once again in the manufacturing and automotive sectors, and some of those funding came from the NSF funds. Then there's the KZN, what we call KZN Special Presidential Project. As part of, and there's actually quite a nice symbolism around the number 76. It was launched on the 16th of June, and it has a reference to the uprising in 1976, the youth uprising, and we've identified as part of that initiative 76 learners through our apprenticeship and learnership programs. We've also availed I can't remember the exact figure, I think 15 million for bursaries. Once again, the focus being rural, the rural areas of KwaZulu-Natal, where we identify students who has the capability but not the resources to attain a qualification. Within the Free State, there's the AAT Accelerated Arts and Development Project. There's a project of handy handicapped learners or learners with disability. Now, the beauty of this project is that these learners, whilst being within school, also went through a learnership. And these are learners with disability, and we've managed to identify 20 of those learners, and these learners have been trained as part of our learnership program. The next one, once again within the Free State in Northern Cape, is within Groot Vlei Correctional Services within the prison. We've identified parolees or pending parolees, or those who might be paroled within the next 12 to 18 months. We've identified 40 of such inmates. We are saying we need to give them an opportunity via skills, so that when they are released from prison, they most probably would find employment. We have also managed already to begin to identify some of our stakeholders within that province who are willing to employ these learners based on some of the programs within that province. Our chairperson being one of the employers of these inmates. There's a similar, just to add to that, there's a similar initiative currently, as much as we have not concluded the agreement, but there's a similar initiative from KZN to also look at training of 200 parolees in different trades, and it's something that really excites us because it contributes to the current priorities of government.
I say that's an important issue for us, so before I forget, we, not so long ago, I think it was 2 or 3 weeks ago, we were requested by the Correctional Services Portfolio Committee. So we had a joint meeting with the Department of Correctional Services and Education and Training and Basic Education around this issue. So it seems to me, out of the initiatives that you are doing, there's a possibility of that strategic engagement. So just remember, we possibly need to facilitate a meeting between, at the very high end, the two committees again, but most probably just representatives, so it's not like a big forum, just to, because the issue is how do we take that request forward, that's what they were asking us, and here you are saying this is what you've done. Obviously you're not training them now and capacitating them to be better equipped to actually...
No, we have a different focus here. We want them to contribute to society in a positive manner. The Free State continuing, we have a science and technology support for learners, and we've identified schools, and we're targeting 100 grade 12 learners, and hopefully within that province, once again, it would be extended to grade 10 and 11. Then there's the Premier's project within the Free State, 250 unemployed youth within the motor mechanics and welding industry. These were placed with the CETA employers. Then these are some of the projects, and I must indicate that the chair of this portfolio committee had a role to play within these projects, particularly within the Northern Cape. Where certain projects have been identified within that particular province, and most of these projects that you're seeing in front of you relates to that particular initiative. But it also begins once again to address the issue of rural development, the issue of engaging CBOs, NGOs, and co-ops, and CETA is actively involved within the Northern Cape to address some of those concerns. In Limpopo, we have a number of projects. The Vula Majuba Artisan Training Project, that actual intake is 200. 60 apprentices have already started. The other 140 will start soon. The project is once again funded by the Mpumalanga Premier's Office, and we once again provide the workplaces or assist in the provisioning of workplaces for those learners. The Public Works Artisan Training Program in Limpopo, 24 artisans have already started, and these will be hosted at Masita Company. So there's a lot of collaboration between Masita. We might not fund these initiatives ourselves, but there's a lot of collaboration, and we are beginning to talk to each other within the provinces as well as across. The last one is the Kolaborba artisan training, where they've identified the areas where we need to train artisans. And we are looking at a partnership once again with the provincial government to address their particular need. Gauteng South, this project, it was actually quite a very big project where we took 250 learners who have successfully completed just recently. I think we just finalized that project recently within this financial year. The level 2 air conditioning learnership, and some of them also have been on the level 3 qualification. And that was once again co-funded by Masita and the Gauteng Department of Economic Development. The Gauteng Department of Public Works, Masita Partnership, it's our regional offices, was in the process of carrying out. We have been requested because some of the, especially within public works, we need to ensure that the workplaces are conducive for learning, and our engagement is to ensure that when these 2,000 learners are placed, they will be placed within workplaces that are able to provide the kind of training that is required in terms of the curriculum. The Industrial Policy Project Department of Economic Development, FETs, AIDC, as an NGO, and Masita, once again, focusing on training of retrenched workers in the scarce and the skills area. And these areas include panel beating, spray painting, warehouse skills, and logistics. And 200 candidates has been earmarked for that particular project. I think I'm going to allow the CEO to continue with this part of the presentation.
Chairperson, I think I did. I did speak earlier to the EBIT initiatives of Masita, the adult education, the accelerated artisan education training, the business, and the occupational. And we once again, these are the projects we are going to engage in. We also would look at adult basic education and training as such. In more so the bursaries that I've highlighted to you earlier, I'm not going to repeat there. The new venture creation, the resource, the retrenchment, the math science, AATP, and then our initiatives with, and this one I want to highlight because I've not spoken to it earlier. The Department of Higher Education and Training, the UIF, Department of Labor, and the MERCETA. And this is looking at a 336 people who were employed, who have some skills, and who draw their stipends for unemployment at the end of the month. The department, we got to the Department of UIF and we said, these people with these skills get into a social cycle where they draw money and never up their skills. So you've got the database. Give us the names of these people. Give the money, because the UIF has got quite a bit of funding, so that we can initiate training. And this is the program we're doing. We're hoping if this is successful in Gauteng, we want to look at replication in other parts of South Africa. We have spoken to, I must say, Chair, our presentation only speaks to the unemployed young people. We did not look at employed people for this particular sitting. It was not a request of this. What are our strategic imperatives? As Masita, and this was stunned, and I must say, a very proactive board, not because I want an increase, Chair, a person of the portfolio committee, a proactive board, but a board who's given very good stewardship. They allow the CETA to function well. That's one of our successes. They steer and we row. And they don't come down the deck and we don't go up. And in doing so, 3 years ago, we sat at the strategic session. What is it? What are our imperatives? And we looked at stock of skills. Let's increase skills available to the sector to meet its short-term needs,
by investing and encouraging investment and innovative thinking. Well, I think the underlining thing there was the innovative thinking. We did not have to think and box ourselves in bureaucracy, but come up with initiatives that can assist the industry. The flow of skills, strengthen the skills pipeline in the medium and long term. And this is things like foundation learning certificate, occupational skills. These are all flow of skills. The workplace learning, by enhancing and capacitating various types of employers in the sector to realize greater returns on training investment and enable employees to benefit from that training by going and working with employees. And as such, Jay, what we did here, and I must share this model with you, we moved away, and I like this, the free thinking they allow us to do. We said at a bank, if you're a good client, they give you a relationship manager. You don't go into the bank to fill in forms. And you pick up a phone and you speak to your relationship manager, and he organizes you a car loan, a house loan, a personal overdraft. That's all. So we looked at our stakeholders as clients, and we appointed client relationship managers. Those are our regional managers. We then appointed client liaison officers, what we traditionally call CLOs, who have a portfolio of clients, companies that he's got to look after, and a one-stop shop. And this has proven to us quite a success, that they could go and service the industry better. Growing the base, empowering beneficiaries and employers to realize that benefit, both by training and being trained. Skills infrastructure to strengthen sector mechanisms for skills planning, implementation, and partnerships. And here we're beginning to talk, Chairperson, and we will need the assistance of this committee and probably through your initiatives to Parliament, where we're beginning to say internationally what linkages can be built. You know, I spoke of one of our weaknesses as global. When I was many years ago in the academic world, they would take you on sabbatical and encourage you to write and to research. And that was part of the development of your the university or the institution. We need to take CETAs the same. A very good friend of mine and a mentor, Professor Merlin Mell, normally says we box ourselves because we think that if we are intelligent, we go to universities. If we're less intelligent, we go to universities of technology. Less intelligent, we go to FETs. And if we can't do anything else, we go to the CETAs. And that mentality begins to permeate throughout, that CETAs are a waste of time. And I must say that the Merck CETA, as leaders in closing that skills gap, wants to break that mindset and saying that one of the things we're very strong in, and some of the members have been at our conference, we have an in-house research division that Wits University has recently awarded Dr. Salim Akuji, a professorship from a CETA. For me, that's a great achievement. And when we employed Salim from the HSRC a few years ago, my mandate to Salim was, you have to come with international papers. If you do not produce at least 2 international papers annually, your contract is discontinued. He's produced more. Our SSP is done wholly internal. And those are the kind of infrastructures that we've improved. In terms of our strategic framework, Chair, and this is how we get paid or not paid, we look at strategic disbursement. Now, this document, I summarized it in here. It gets spent out much more. How do we, effective business systems do we bring into this thing? Strategic fund allocation for the systems. Addressing identified training needs. And here you can see, Chair, what is our current level, the target for it, as levy income disbursement, current level plus 20% improvement. Surplus disbursement, current level, and we want to bring down those surpluses by minus 20%. We brought it down by minus 33 last year. Our rand amount of sector skills requirement disbursement, ratio improvement 20%. Our SLA with Department of Higher Education and Training, nothing less than 100% compliance. The senior management team as well as staff does not get performance bonuses. These things are not met because you pay to do a certain job. Our Mercita functional matrix. Here's our corporate services. Here we built in a 5-year retention of our critical skills. What we want to do is at least retain our top people, 90% of them, over the 5 years. That's our critical skill. We realize that the industry is one of movement. People move between CETAs. But that's why I said this earlier, that we've not lost any of our senior management thus far. Our corporate governance, the board is supported in achieving this purpose. And we've exposed the board to King 3. We've exposed them to university training, to any form of development of that board. And I must say here, before Professor James would ask me this question, our board is not paid. It's a consultant 8 years ago in the industry. It was one of the criticisms I had. The moment you pay CETA boards is when they sit for more meetings. And I wish I could share a report with you that I wrote on the CETA that I said, that's your problem, that's your downfall. And I brought that, becoming CEO of the MERS CETA, that we're not paying our boards. We do pay a sitting allowance, but to the industry. We do pay NUMSA, we do pay the RMI, the members here, but not directly, not individually. And we pay you for a maximum of 4 board meetings. If you sit more than that, your board becomes dysfunctional. In terms of operations, we want 70% of large companies participating. And you've noticed we pushed this quite hard. The leadership chair, very much so, and I think that's very important to us, our people management, our leadership within the sector, and keeping us abreast of it. So these are... Then very lastly, something we take for granted is brand health. How do we ensure that the Mercedes brand becomes a brand associated with training and development within the manufacturing engineering sector? I say thank you, Chairperson. And we will sit for any questions to any of us. Members of the Portfolio Committee, I don't know if it's my age or what, but I had problems reading that this morning, but I think it was early for me. My email address is ceo@mercita.org.za. My direct number to my office is 011-551-5338. I do not possess a cell phone. Any questions? Thank you.
And that comes from somebody that wanted to get rid of all CETAs. just remember that. And we tried to explain the majority of the CETAs or the principles are good. Let's not throw them maybe after the past water. Thanks, Chairperson, Deputy Chairperson, CEO, CFO, COO. Is it corporate?
Yes. It's what we call in business a company secretary. That's okay. Tom's job.
Okay. Let me start off by asking. I see you've omitted, unless I was missing that, which I possibly was. You've omitted the issue about vacancies, the whole employment equity arrangements, the staff complement, all of that issues.
See, it is in your pack.
I saw it in the pack. I'm saying you didn't like... You just feel that, you didn't even allude that people can just look into it. Also, I think it was a provider analysis and so on and so on.
Can I quickly...
Yeah?
Give me
you don't need to get into all these.
I won't get
just
into
it.
Chairperson, I must say in our provider analysis, I'm going to start with that document, that we have as black spend into our black businesses owners, we have a spend of 82%, 42%, not something that we're extremely proud of. But we understand the makeup of the industry. Because we work within industry in manufacturing and engineering, which is very capital intensive, it's not soft skills. So people don't have the capital investment to lay out on training. And training profits are not realized immediately. They realize over time. And our training mostly takes place within companies and not with private providers. So that's how it's spent. I don't want to apologize for that, but I want to give you the reasoning for that. In terms of our, and we've given you a list of the people we've provided or who are training.
In terms of our board membership, it's totally elected by the industry. We have a membership of 15 black, and black being colored Indian African, and 17 white, 32 members on the board. Our membership in terms of gender has also improved since I took over. We have a female chairperson of the industry, and proudly to say this, not a token, but a person who owns a business, one of the largest panel shops, and who knows spray painting. I've been in Canada with her, and I've seen. She exactly knows and tells me this is primer, this is what they're doing, and then she told me she did it herself. So we bring in real skills of people. In terms of our staff, senior management chair, I want to deal with that first. We are 83% black in our senior management. If you've seen today, that's our senior management. We have one white male, our projects manager. If we will give a further breakdown, I don't like it much, but we have 50% black, 33% colored, and 17% white. That's our breakdown. And I'm very proud of working for an organization like this. In terms of our staff complement, we have 207 people working for the Mercy Chart. 39% male, 61% female, 63% African, 3% Indian, 20% colored, and 14% white. We look at it, 86% of our staff is black. Once again, very proud working for an organization like this. Thank you. None. I must say that. Is one of the leading 39 companies to work for. We've succeeded in we do have vacancies from time to time, but we close them very quickly. We have also recently our SME manager resigned, and instead of, and I listened to what Corey said earlier, instead of applying or getting somebody in for 10 months for the job, we decided to take one of our other managers and broaden the scope of that particular position. It also allows our managers to become better. I can also say this. In the last 3 years, we appointed internally only. Our COO comes internally. He was promoted internally. Our corporate governance manager came internally from company secretary to GM. Our HR manager, our corporate services manager was responsible for HR, communications, and IT, was HR manager, and Muketi Nyana Mayongo, and it was also an internal promotion. So what we've seen there is a development of staff within the organization.
Can I say thank you to the chairperson, the deputy chairperson, and the CEO and all others? The one, I think we really want to thank the presenters. It is a strategic presentation. It deals with, and that's why I'm concerned that they were sitting in the room earlier. But then I tried to analyze what's on there and what was printed earlier, and it's the same. So I was wondering if somebody was using. Yeah. And the chairperson of this board, she's a very strategic person, and the deputy chairperson as well. So I just had to quickly reflect on all those documents. But so definitely put, you've done exceptionally well in terms of at the level of strategy and operations. I think what we're seeing differently in this input to the other one, now remember this is only two seats that we've seen, is that there is a strategic reflection on the provinces and the alignment to poverty, as well as the skill gap analysis per province. So interesting, even though there's percentage member companies in a province, at times based on the type of interventions, the investment there would be a little bit lower, taking into account the strategic reflection on what the country's needs would be in particular provinces or municipalities. So I think that's something there, that there's a model there that needs to be unpacked a little bit further. The issue on, and then operational, all these other projects, just the question, NSDS draft
comment? Are we very happy? What is our concern? We look, there's all the wonderful things that's in the documents, but what would be the two or three things that, that in a sense you would feel needs to be raised and which you obviously would be able to unpack more and more and deeper? I think there is an impact on either to you or away from you, and what would that be? So just that quickly, and then I'll allow the various members to... Member Gina has just left. So can we possibly get... is it Member James? And then Member Lachetro and Member Kubai. And then all of our members are very interested too. But what I'll do is I'll hear how those questions come and then see if we shouldn't like just get responses as we... So let's get the first two.
Yeah, no, just congratulations. I mean, you're a model of what a CETA should be doing. So that's really quite fabulous. I was curious just in terms of the range of technologies that you actually support in terms of training and what the overlap is with the health sector. Medical devices, for example. You're in the plastics industry, and there's all kinds of innovation in the plastics industry when it comes to the manufacturing of stents, for example. And in the Western Cape, there's a growing silicon medical devices expansion happening. Just curious, what do you do any joint projects with other CETAs, in other words?
Member
Fisher. Thank you, Chair. You're talking about regional offices. Do you have regional offices in all the provinces? That's my first question. The second question, you are saying that on Cape Town old building, you have identified 15 unemployed learners, and then you continue to say Wolfsburg College will be training provider. Who is paying this provider? Lastly, I'm very, very happy that you take out unemployed learners from the street, 2,400, 1,600, 200. That goes to almost 4,000. But given the number of the extent of unemployment in our country, dropouts from the universities of more than 2 million, we're not talking about the others. Do you think you are doing enough with this? About 4,000. You see, we are seeing violent eruption all over the country, and when you look at these people, age-wise, they are very youth, and how do you intervene there? Thanks, Shepherd.
Yeah, thank you, Shepherd, and thank you for the presentation. Terminology, maybe I'm being too petty. Constantly using region, but reflecting provinces. But also, maybe it explains why you have other provinces stand alone. Somewhere you talk of a region is called Free State Northern Cape. It's Mpumalanga. Why can't we just say in Free State this is what we have, in Mpumalanga, in Northern Cape this is what we have? Why can't we just split the way our provinces are? And then the second thing, Chairperson, is the almost invisibility of FET colleges. I don't see much of them, particularly on your list of providers, who the providers are, why they have been paid. I don't see FET colleges much. Certainly, I'm not sure if I heard correctly. You were saying that you are only dealing with unemployed learners. I guess in learnership, you're talking about your 18.2. I think those who are employed also need to be skilled. Those who are employed also want to be skilled. Is there a special reason why? Is it a policy decision, or is it just what is happening because there's no request to assist the workers who are already employed?
Okay, your hand was up, so. Thank you. Mic off.
Member
Thank you, Chairperson. CEO, your pages are not numbered, but where you speak of region, company, and so on this page, which is not numbered, I see the other provinces are coupled together, like Gauteng, coupled with the Northwest, and Free State also coupled. I want to know, why are they coupled? It would be perhaps better if we know Gauteng get this so much percentage and Northwest so much percentage. So it's glaring if it's like that, we cannot know which one gets what. And my second question is, to what extent is Mercita effectively and actively spread in the nine provinces, and particularly in the deep rural areas of each province, where the majority of young people are residing and the skill shortage is so glaring? Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. I think I echo the sentiments in terms of just appreciating the presentation and just the comfort of feeling that at least things here are normal and are going well. But just wanted to make the comment. I was looking at the stats in terms of the board chairperson, but transformation needs to be the non-gender issues. We are very limited in terms of number of females, and especially because the industry is a bit of a challenge. So it would be important to encourage those females who are there as participation into this type of a board as well. So I felt that we needed just to highlight that. And then there was the issue, CEO, on your SWOT analysis where you spoke about insufficient delivery of learnership, which I just wanted you to more elaborate. What are the challenges here, and how do we find a way out of this challenge of the threat of insufficient learnership? And then lastly, on the RAP, Retrenchment Assistance Program, noting that you've managed to get about 4,000 candidates on board, what was your target in terms of looking? Because I understand that this is one of the industry that has been hit hard in terms of the global crisis. So what has been there, and then what has been the response from the sector itself? How many people we anticipated to take? And because I don't think that 4,000 was my expectation from this sector would have been more, in terms of how we've been looking at what has happened in the sector. And lastly, Chair, in the issue of career guidance, in terms of just exposing what support is coupled with the financial support with the career guidance, let the students come or whoever comes to the center, sees I'm interested in this, are there opportunities, financial opportunities that you provide as a sector or as a CETA, or linkage with other sectors or the employers to be able to provide that financial support for the students to pursue their studies in this particular sector? Thanks.
Thank you. I had a team presenting with me, and I hope they don't desert me and now leave me alone. They are very much part of us. The question, Chair, your question in terms of what are the issues around NSDS. Now, we've made an analysis of the NSDS, and we're doing a formal response. The first is around the signing of the SSP. I think though the intention being noble to get so many partners to sign up, it's practically going to be a nightmare. You're going to deadlock. You know, it's you're going back to a CODESA 1 by looking at this, the way it's been set up. It's not an ideal. You have industry representatives and let them take the responsibility. The whole issue of the grant system Chair, I'll first give my personal opinions, so I would like to say this. For, I've been involved in skills development since its inception, since 2000, since ITA started. I worked up as a consultant for 2 years before I took on a job as a CEO in 2003. And in that period, what I've been exposed to is the fact that our discretionary grant is a transformational grant. It is a grant that accelerates training and can address past imbalances and get, for instance, the gold question of women representativity. If we continue to pay 50% mandatory grant, or even reducing it by 40% and bringing in the pivotal grant, it is not beginning to address the issue of scarce and critical skills in the industry. I've recently done a study and a tour to Brazil on Brazil skills, and I was very, the deputy chair was on that tour. What we were exposed to was that Brazil had a levy scheme since 1942, sharing international best practice. Companies who train do not submit WSPs. It's a waste of money or, you know, time. Those are the kind of things that we... Now, we must begin to address that in our NSDS3, saying, how do we incentivize companies greater to train without giving them the bureaucratic burden of training? I think that's what CITES, or what the NSDS3... So those are my concerns. One is the whole issue of the grant being paid, that it's still too high. You need to increase the whole issue of discretionary grants so that you begin to address the issue of an unemployed youth, a community which is not properly skilled or half-skilled. The community I come from, where I lived in Rega Park, Boksburg, everybody was a welder. And I still maintain, Wayne and I talk about this now and again when we sit alone, that if you walk into, let's use Mitchell's Plain as an example, know the community pretty well, you will find welders if you walk in there. You might not find arc welders. Are we beginning to address that? How does our skills begin to say, this is the skill of the person, how do we take him to that level? And that, you can only do that through a heavy government intervention. And it is your committee that has to drive this, Chair. And I think that's where I'm saying the NSDS3 needs to take care of it. It is the vehicle, the instrument. Singapore is a very good example. If you want to skill your people, you do it from a very high level. In Singapore, it is done from a presidential office. That's why Singapore has a high literacy rate. But take a first world country, we need to look at that way. Let me answer the questions, and Professor James has just walked in, so I can do the first one. Do we do any joint projects? One of the things we begin to address now is beginning to work with other CETAs. We have a crossover with Service CETA. Both of us are training artisans. They train artisans that fall within the labor market pool. It's not within us. We could not say that we are the sole owner of that qualification, but we want to say, let's set the standards and work together. On the other hand, we train new venture creation, a qualification which they run, and we're working together. Together, a very good relationship, for instance, to show this, is that we have now decided to take it upon ourselves between our management, that includes the chair, deputy chair, CEO, and theirs, to drive World Skills South Africa. And we'll be funding it to improve our standard of skills. It is not elitist to compete abroad. Then we should withdraw our Bafana Bafana team if it is elitist to compete internationally. You see, we can compete with soccer and netball and cricket, but when it comes to skills, we say it's elitist. Why must we send our learners abroad to compete? And that's the reason why we're not getting the right type of people, and we began to address this. So we, in terms of the education training practice with ETDP CETA, that's our relationship. I fortunately, for my own sins, Chairperson, was chairperson of the Artisan Development Committee, a committee that oversees all artisan training within the CETAs. And that led to collaboration. We look at what they call the TSBC, Transnet, Sasol, two mining houses, and just one of the big, we call them the Big Six, who train extensively. And we're saying, in terms of the artisan development program, accelerated artisan training program, we've done the work, we've got the model, so we're working together with Transport CETA, Mining CETA, and the other CETAs regarding this. Member Lekhetlo asked me about regional offices, and I want to unpack this thing about, because there was quite a number of questions on regional versus provincial. When we look at region, or when we speak of province, we speak of a demarcation of a province, as demarcated by the demarcation board. We looked at the region as a financial decision. Now, the economies of scale have taught us that it's very expensive to go and put up a building that is not visited regularly or used. So in that case, we looked at the population spread between Northern Cape and Free State. We have an office in Kimberley, but we have the main office in Bloemfontein because it's 100 kilometers away, 130 kilometers. So it would be foolish for us to go and have two offices and the salary and the expenses. So we've got a smaller office there. We've now also seen that the number of companies around, that was a determining factor, because that's what we service. We service companies. And that also answers the question, I'm jumping a bit, but I want to answer it. We don't only train unemployed learners. We also train employed workers. For this presentation, the question was how many unemployed. We have trained last year over 18,000 employed workers in skills programs, apprenticeship programs, and so forth. And we can give you the background. In terms of full qualification, learnerships and apprenticeships, we have trained over 6,800 on that one. So we are very active in, and that's why we have NUMSA there, otherwise, and Solidarity and FIDUSA. That really gives us the stick. Who pays Falls Bay College? What we do have a direct relationship with the colleges. We do pay colleges directly. These are FET colleges. And you would see in our annual report, Pillar, financial term, third party, related party transactions. We pay universities and colleges. We have MOUs with two colleges, we've got two colleges recognized as institutes of sectoral and occupational excellence. One for welding in the Western Cape,
West Coast
College, Saldanha, and the other one in the Eastern Cape, East Cape Midlands College. And there we were responsible for setting up the whole welding school. Then we have MOUs with nine other colleges. In fact, it's increasing now, that we use as trade test centers. We're beginning to encourage our own institutions to deliver. So we have that relationship with the colleges. Is 4,000 enough? Member of Parliament, if I one day am big, I want to become a Member of Parliament. I'm still small. So I would say this, it's not. It's a drop in the ocean, I know that. We're sitting with a population of 48 million. We're sitting with currently an age group of 18 to 24, 6.8 million people, of which 1.8 million are actively employed. Now, that's a time bomb waiting for us. And those are the people. Now, you know, I did a breakdown and I did a presentation to CIFSA last week on this. Out of that, 6.8 million people, there are approximately 2 million that have either matric and further education. And what do they do? When they don't have anything to do, they're going to toy around there. As MERS CETA, it's a problem that CETAs are facing, and this is what we can address with the funding available. If we had more funding, I'm sure we would try and go for more. Mr. Hannes Wynne is here, and I must say, and throw in my little crunch here, Hannes, and saying that it is therefore the MERS CETA's position that we would like to be part of that new main CETA, the manufacturing CETA, that we want to do more because we have the capacity to do more. In terms of gender, I like that question and it will come to us. You know, the first thing 3 years ago when we turned around Mercita, and it was a titanic to turn around. I'm now with Mercita 4 years. It's very difficult. First thing we did, we entered into a program with UNISA called Women in Management. And we trained 50 people. We now can say 3 years later, we now have 350 employed women in industry at various universities on management programs, including MBAs. And that's the one way we can start influencing. Just a bit of stats. I used to lecture the subject, so I like it. The one thing is that 18% of managers within the sector are black. 17% are women. Across all colors. So we really need to start looking at that aspect of management. You know, and for the Mercy, we have to put funds available and say, we're not only going to look at scarce and critical skills, welders, fitters, turners, we need to look at people managing. Because we might sit with a society one day where it comes and says, Jean says, this is a good fitter or a good panel beater, so I must promote him to management with no skills. And that's why we're beginning to address the management skills, and in so doing, women. I'm going to give Wayne the issue of the learnerships issue. He's an expert on that, the question around learnerships, if he doesn't mind. But before, whilst he's preparing there, what is the target for our retrenchment assistance plan? The training layoff scheme was very driven from outside. We had no control. The company experiences problems. It goes to the CCMA, the Department of Labor, and then with us. And that's when we introduced the retrenchment assistance plan. And we're beginning to say that we set aside an amount of 80 million rand for that, meaning that we want to look at plus minus 10,000 people. We are aware that 36,000 people were retrenched in the last previous quarters. The career guidance, the financial aspects, we can say when we bring them to the center, we make sure that they are catered for. No expenses. We also want to popularize our career centers and take it to the Mitchell's Plain center, what do you call it, this shopping center there, to the urban shopping centers. We want to expose kids at the centers on a Saturday morning and show them, here's a tractor, here's a massive big tractor, a ganda-ganda, but this is how you work on it. This is what you can do. This is how you become an artisan. We want to, what I call, sexify the industry to our careers. But we've then realized, Jay, we pay quite a bit of money for learners at universities. I, as a parent, had a kid in engineering, and no. Your repetition rates are very high. And we pay for that repetition as a country. You know, kids, instead of a four-year degree, take 6 years to complete it. And we started addressing this problem. And what we did with the new CEO of EXA, Ozzy Franks, sat and we brainstormed. We then employed within the project a math science coordinator that supports the universities. Our universities are also overcrowded. Kids go there, they get lost. What we did with these few students in engineering through EXA's initiative, we then gave them bursary. Together, working with a NESFAS combination of it to stretch our rent further. The person then tracks these learners, checks their marks. Dolly is an expert maths and science person. Speaks to the lecturers, tells them these are the problems that kids are experiencing. Speaks to the kids, relates back. So we begin to support the holidays. We are supporting these learners through practical experience with the Engineering Council. That's what we're doing with careers. Wayne can just answer that.
Chair, I want to cry and I be excused, please.
through you, Chair, with regards to the insufficient delivery of learnerships, I think it's twofold. One, there has been as much as we have had the qualifications registered, there was a lack of learning material or curricula to deal with implementation of those learnerships. And I think MECITA has, over the last most probably 2 years, invested to the tune of 40 million to develop the learning material and curriculums for all the qualifications within our sector to try and fast track the delivery of those learnerships. The other issue is around progression. I think at times learners enter the learnership at level 2, and I think the CEO alluded to it earlier, and never progress to a level 3 or level 4 learnership. The whole issue of learnership hopping tends to be a challenge within the CETA fraternity, and those are the two issues that relates to insufficient delivery of learnership. This is some of the discussions that's going around. Is at one stage we might have to consider entering into a 3-year kind of learnership agreement that takes the person from level 2 up to level 4. And in doing so, we will also force companies to ensure that the learner progress to a level where the learner can become fully employable and be regarded as in fully fledged artisan at the end of the learnership program. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, thank you very much. You said we need to comment on the NSDS3 draft document. I think from our point of view, it's a good, strategy, which begins to say to to MECITA, don't only look inward in terms of skills development and interventions, but support the objectives of the developmental state, where, for example, we need to align our strategies with the current, NSDS 3, together with the human resource development strategy. But over and above that, it is beginning to say the five MECITA subsectors, should develop strategies in order to respond to the new opportunities provided, by this developmental state. Two examples that I can cite. There is going to be a recycling, of papers and plastics. So to what an extent that the plastic sector can align, its strategies in order to make sure that when that recycling, comes to the fore, we are having, skills ready to intervene. The second one is the tire, recycling. To what an extent can we ensure that we are developing skills immediately in order to respond? The last issue in terms of adding to what the CEO cited as one of the challenges around the RAP. During the economic, recession, a number of employers over and above the retrenchment, reduced the number of working days to 2 or 3 days per week. But now that things are beginning to stabilize, employers are working now 5 days a week, and some of the employers 4 days a week. And if you are working 4 days a week, it is very, very difficult. In fact, you don't qualify to apply to the training, layoff scheme. And that's another challenge where, the applications through the training layoff scheme will be reduced, because most of the companies now are working 4 days a week
where, in terms of the requirements, those employees are not entitled to apply. Thanks.
Let's thank the Mercita. I think we've indicated the fact that we appreciate the presentation, but also the context and the content and the strategy. I think two weeks ago we were invited, and we spent 2 days, most of the committee members, with Mercita, and it was very informative. But again, after I think also addressing some conference of your end of last year, one can say that whatever you've presented here as a board, that there is that coherence, that model that we referred to earlier. The dynamic interaction between the board and the management is clearly there and into the workforce. There's, I think, is it the researcher that just passed a particular note? There are many people with skills in the manufacturing industry. However, they have no qualifications. What can Mercita do to RPL these workers in order to address the skills shortage? So, and it's not RPL under essentials just of, you know, you've worked for 5 years and therefore you're just getting it, but it's how the enhancement will take place. We don't necessarily want to, we don't want to answer now, but it's something we've just met last, was it yesterday? Remember, Kubai, we've actually met one of the university directors where we've drilled down on this thing. We're extremely concerned as a committee that government language is right when it comes to RPL, but the implementation is not necessarily there. Whether it, at the university level in particular and also in those documentations. So we've got a perspective, and we need to test that. And how do we actually drill into the RPLing and upscale that process? Not in necessarily in its historical context only, but really what is required in the current context. I think the second point is the fact that it's this training layoff scheme. Again, you've referred to it, Deputy Shepherdson, and we've heard that in the earlier presentation. So there's something there that we're going to have to take up and reflect on. The question relating to, I think I raised the point around the Grootvlei and the correctional services and the partnerships that we would want to get into, and we'll facilitate that. Then just the retention. Reality is, as you upscale technical people, there is 1,000 and more engineers in the UK as we're sitting here. And that's the reality. It's South African engineers. It's being recruited internationally. And it's got nothing to do with Dr. Patel with a point around how do you actually take a component of your learners and actually expose them into the world. That's not the point. It's to do with how do you, as you train and upskill, how do you link them up? The reality is we are saying that 78 or 80 municipalities, I was yesterday with the head of turnaround interventions in the country for municipalities, 80 municipalities sit without technical skills. Now, we are saying that the last 5 years, but we are training people on the other side. And that gap, that link between getting out of the university and possibly to more point to yourself in the department and getting back into the technical opportunity. Now, there is a reason why people do not like to go into the public sector, engineers and artisans. If you go in as an engineer into the public sector, you actually become a paper pusher, nothing else. You go into the industry, you become a competent engineer after 4 or 5 years. That's the difference. So in the apartheid state, what they had was this construction workers, for example. Then you had this road camps, say in the 50s, in the 60s, etc. Then what has happened is as the apprenticeship and the university process took place, then they've been deployed into the construction road camps. Then you've got an experienced high-level technical skill, with, say, for example, lower levels of skill. But it became a training ground. But if you're now going to public works from an engineer, becoming an engineer, and you go to public works or you go to any public sector structure, not your parastatals, but in this case the department, 5 years down the line you will actually be less competent than the other person that graduated with you. So that's a real issue. So there's something that we will have to do, and we'll speak to our different chairpersons in the committee. But the reality is, as we are speaking, there is a flood of people that you are training. How do we actually turn that around? How do we stop that? How do we give them the avenue, in fact, to have that international experience but come back? It's all those things. And it's a concern where we would be searching. On your ownership package, and I've looked at the documents, the question they've been given, you can't really speak about there's information not there because it's drilling down. Correctly so, because up till now you didn't have to comply even as a CFO with that type of question. But I think you understand what's starting to take place. We're starting to follow. Now, if you actually take the 42%, if you actually take the 81 million on ownership, black owned, is that real? You understand what I'm saying? So if we put an empowerment impact assessment model onto that 82%, I actually think it's going to drill down. And if you look at the supply chain, apart from the actual training and the supply, the accommodation, the food, the training material, the booklets being put together, where is that, for example? So yes, black owned, but if you actually look at where the supply in the construction environment, 60% of the opportunity would go straight into the supply. You understand? And that means, and if you actually unpack the supply, then you'll see a different ballgame. So those are the hard questions that we'll be getting into, because we know that at the end of the day, the call on the ground and the call from our communities and society at large is that we've won political power, but economic power is evading our society and our communities. And I think those are the issues that we'll be having to get into. Then, if we're...
Chair, yeah? I'm sorry, I don't wish to be rude, but I thought the meeting was ending at 22:01.
We are concluding.
And...
we are concluding.
Yes, and I have to leave right now, and I just didn't want to leave without those thanking Mercita, and also thanking you for arranging this.
Mm.
It's been one of the most enlightening meetings I think we've had.
Okay. Thank you, Member James. Well, the last point, I think, is the model issue. Is it possible that your brilliant research unit within Mercita, right, because you've mentioned the individual as well, is it possible, Dr. Patel and the chairperson, that we can get the success factor methodology? Do a little bit, what is that processing? What does a board need to look like? And then not the faces I'm speaking, but the business processing in the board, the approach. What is that methodology that's working? What's the methodology in the management? What is that methodology in ups? You are showing all these senior managers, and they actually come from within. How did that work? Meaning, can you do an analysis and a research on your own success? And can that be something that we then will flip into a space somewhere in August? So it's not like dwelling down for 6 months. It is what you in any case are doing, is just to step a little bit back and say, why is this actually a success factor? And is there an opinion of the methodology that we can actually use, but in a sense, put a guidance together for other cities. And obviously we'll be picking, not necessarily for other cities, but for the new landscape. We are going to ask other cities that similar question where we know it's working. And then we'll most probably be able to come with the best practical stuff that has worked in the past. Then to go and write a theoretical page that it's not underpinned by real experiences and lessons learned over the last couple of years, because I think even this CETA had at some stage a turnaround on CEOs and instability in that space, and now we've seen the last couple of years of stability. But again, unqualified reports in terms of the compliance issues, but also the way you are actually giving performance bonuses. It's not an issue of only if you do the basics. You must be able to showcase beyond the basics. So thanks a lot, and members. We've been challenged today because we knew that there was two or three other events taking place, including a public hearing. And I think our WIP was supposed to be in another meeting with WIPs. Thanks for staying on till the very end. Thanks a lot.
and the department as well.
Yeah. I was thinking you're going to have to leave way earlier.